I think our society is run by insane people for insane objectives. And I think that's what I sussed when I was 16 and 12, way down the line. But I expressed it differently all through my life. It's the same thing I'm expressing all the time. But now I can put it into that sentence that I think we're being run by maniacs for maniacal ends, you know. If anybody can put on paper what our government and the American government, etc., and the Russian, Chinese, what they are actually trying to do, you know, and how, what they think they're doing, I'd be very pleased to know what they think they're doing. I think they're all insane. You know, but I'm liable to be put away as insane for expressing that.
So it's Friday. It's, well, what is it, 24 minutes past five, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 27th of May 2022. Thanks very much for everyone who's been hanging on in there. A bit of a problem with the buses here in Bristol today, and chock-a-block on Stokes Croft traffic. Loads of roadworks, which have been going on for about 8 months. Actually, they seem to be enjoying the roadworks now, because there's so many roads in the city have been shut off by the mayor, or narrowed down to one little lane, where actually there's room on the road for two or more, with these cycle lanes now that aren't used hardly, that traffic chaos is almost, well, it's a hostile environment for car drivers, and it will be even more of a hostile environment for diesel drivers that haven't got a brand new car very soon here. Anyway, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol, and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, relentlessly gaslighting us with military-grade psychological warfare, with Ukraine propaganda. And what about the medical misinformation? Tens of thousands of Brits dying unnecessarily. And the London media lies now just forgotten? Well, anyway, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, very apposite this week with the World Economic Forum meeting, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So, part one today, we've got Kevin Carhill, ex-Sunday Time journalist, talking about the rich list, talking about people's land holdings, and also about Labour's lifetime gifts tax, which we touched on briefly last week. The idea that something like 20 times more people, that's 5 million or so, would be unable to hand on their homes to their children. This is Labour's idea of some sort of great pat on the back for people, but of course it's not necessarily going to work, that. And so also Levellers Day, a report from Levellers Day in Burford last Saturday, where I was, a chat to Richard Burgeon, MP. As also next week we'll be doing a Civil War timeline. I've been finding out quite a lot about the Civil War, particularly after last week, last Saturday, at Levellers Day. So you can look forward to that next week. If you're interested in the Civil War, I find it fascinating. It's like, you know, it's only really after World War II that we started to understand what was going on with writers like Christopher Hill, etc., and E.P. Thompson. And in part two, Texas shooting, a couple of items on that. Also, we're taking a zoom in on the main oligarch behind both the Ukrainian government now and their relationship with the United States and NATO. That's Viktor Pinchuk. And of course, if you remember from a few weeks ago, he was the guy named by the Ukrainian Soviet era uniformed general, who was talking about him running the main Masonic lodge, being the master of the Ukraine lodges, Viktor Pinchuk. Also, of course, massively wealthy oligarch. And here we'll be hearing him just before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, speaking at the Munich Security Conference just the weekend before the Russians went in. And we'll also be looking at what Henry Kissinger at World Economic Forum has been saying about all of this. The great internet ad swindle. This is the entire market of internet advertising. Could be fake. Very interesting thing by the BBC. And, of course, this is one reason we should keep the BBC, because they don't have to do programmes which pander to the advertisers. So they've been doing some very good work, actually, on looking at how what a mess the advertising market is in, something that the commercial broadcasters won't touch with a barge pole, because, of course, they're making money out of it, whilst possibly people aren't even seeing the adverts. And the other thing on the tech side, from the BBC too, World Service, is, when is mute not mute? So when you mute your microphone, is it actually muting it? No, the answer is no, it's not. It's still transmitting everything you're saying down the line. It's just, it's not necessarily being recorded or transmitted to the other people in the call. Fascinating, I thought. Anyway, and finally, Porton Down, we hear from Gordon Bell, who was a victim in Porton Down. He's now living out over in Alberta, Canada, or he was when I spoke to him a couple of years ago. So, cancelled off Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, and Iranian and Russian news is now cancelled by the telecoms cartel and Ofcom, but not cancelled here. So, Martin, let's start by looking at the World Economic Forum and Kissinger. You just as we were chatting whilst we were waiting for the bus to trundle through Bristol, You were saying that he was speaking at the WEF this week.
Yeah, I mean, I just saw a brief report of his comments. Basically, he was saying that there would have to be a negotiated solution in Ukraine, and if there wasn't, then the danger was of a wider war, etc. And of course, you know, in many ways, that's pretty obvious. But he came, you know, lots of other people piled in and said, "Oh no, no." So, you know, there's definitely a lot of to-ing and fro-ing at that level of the international apparatus.
Well, there certainly is. Kissinger is one of these people that seems to enjoy creating conflicts, don't you think, rather than trying to sort them out?
Well, Kissinger obviously has got a track record of being involved in everything the deep state have done in the US for many decades. He's still still an important figure, even though he's 98. But of course, you know, there are conflicts within ruling classes and ruling groups about what the best strategies are. And I think it's fascinating that Kissinger is basically such a knuckle-dragger in so many ways, is now the voice of reason compared to,
loads of others. People love doing this, don't they? I mean, I've been studying the Bilderbergers for decades now, and Kissinger is quite good at doing this. Every time there's some conflict that he's been involved in creating, he stands there on the public. Obviously, he's got a massive public profile, and it's very easy to get him all over the news. He finds that very easy. He will say, oh, I think we're going too far. I remember an equivalent of Kissinger back in the 1990s, Peter Carrington, the ex Secretary General of NATO and chairman of the Bilderbergers at the time, plus also very much involved in the Battle of Arnhem. If anyone's seen my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, looking at Carrington's role there in leaving the 1st Airborne Division to die, basically, at the Arnhem Bridge, when they could quite easily have gone down the road, just trundled down the road and helped them out with their tanks. The attitude of Carrington back then and Kissinger now is, well, we've started these conflicts, but we want to also be the people to say, oh, this is, we're going too far. People like you, Martin, don't really have the voice on the international media that people like Carrington or Kissinger do. But actually, in a way, you're saying similar things.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with your characterisation of the situation. I think what you've got is there's an older guard who are aware that in actual fact there are limits to Western power, and there's a younger guard basically lacking in experience. Think of Liz Truss, for example, who think that we can fight to victory in the Ukraine.
It's not just experience she's lacking, is it?
Well, it's not just that, but I think the point is that you've got very much... Kissinger, love him or hate him, and I, of course, hate him, is a heavyweight, whereas the people in charge now are lightweights, and they don't understand that if you go to war, you can lose.
Didn't he make his name from doing a book about nuclear war? This is a big thing in the 50s and 60s, wasn't it?
Well, I think that you're thinking of Herman Kahn, who was a nuclear war... he believed in winning nuclear wars. I think
Kissinger wasn't saying that. He was saying basically his book, I believe, was about how to stop a nuclear war. Really?
Well, I don't actually read. I haven't read all of Kissinger's great magnum opuses, as you can imagine. I'm aware of him, and of course Christopher Hitchens demolishing of him in his autobiography, or not autobiography, in his biography of Kissinger.
Yeah, the trial of Henry Kissinger, which was his kind of fantasy about this guy being put on trial and behind bars, and he saw that as, you know, if the West can't do that, then the West isn't free at all, and it's not democratic.
Yeah, and it's not. And Kitchens was right about that, but he then decided he was going to support the invasion of Iraq, so there we go. I think that what's actually happening is an older guard, as I say, are getting cold feet about the reckless nature of Western policy. And, you know, those people are, they can see that they're going to lose the war in the Ukraine and they want to cut their losses, whereas other idiots like our Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary want to win an outright victory in the Ukraine with no negotiations, which is frankly absolutely barking.
Well,
that is never going to happen.
Just looking it up, Kissinger's 1957 book, Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy, was supposed to be very, very influential. He was saying, and for many of us, of course, this is absolutely dead obvious, and Americans have got a habit of doing things or saying things which actually seem very obvious, is that attempts to win a nuclear war would leave all equally devastated.
Well, yes, no, you know, that's hardly Sherlock Holmes there, is it? I think the real political significance of this is that Soros, for example, has immediately lashed out at Kissinger. He wants an outright victory. So you've got all these, you know, old guys, deep staters, at each other's throats.
Okay, before we get stuck into Viktor Pinchuk, which I was going to leave until part two, but since we're on Ukraine now, I think we should, you know, look a little bit more closely at what you think are the causes of the Ukraine conflict, Martin.
Well, I mean, the underlying causes go back to the creation of the state in 91 with the collapse of the disorderly collapse of the Soviet Union. Because Ukraine had never been a state before that. It was an administrative region in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And it basically changed its configuration during that time. For example, the Crimea was added in 1954 by Khrushchev, which at the time didn't have much significance, but subsequently became quite significant. And underlying all of that is that it's not really a homogenous society or state. It's quite a big place. You've got Ruthenian speakers in the West who are the real Ukrainian nationalists, and in the east part of the region, because that's what it is, Ukraine just means borderland. You've got Russian-speaking people who've been there since the 19th century, and then quite a lot who went there during industrialization in the 50s. So, you know, the idea that there is a homogenous Ukrainian people is simply wrong. The Ukraine, as I say, just means borderland, and the actual ethnic origin of the what you would call real Ukrainians is Ruthenians, and they've got a slightly different language from Russian, slightly different language than Polish. They write it in Latin script rather than Cyrillic script, same as the split between Serbs and Croats in Yugoslavia. The language is virtually identical, but the Croats write it in Latin script and the Serbs write it in Cyrillic script.
Well, and then there was 2014, which I was talking about briefly at the beginning, which was when this Ukrainian general spoke out saying, well, actually, look at these Yatsenyuk and the rest of them, they're all Freemasons. But 2014 was critical, wasn't
it? Yes, of course. I mean, the underlying factors are 91 and the creation of the state, and during the subsequent period, the politics in the Ukraine was a balancing act between the interests of the East and the West. So there was a bit of a seesaw battle. Kuchma was the president at one stage, and he, you know, there had to be a trade-off, that the interests of both groups had to be represented. There was a bit of a struggle about it. The Orange Revolution, that was backed up by Berezovsky, led to Yevtushenko coming to power. Then there was Tymoshenko, both of whom were more extreme nationalists. And then you've got Yanukovych, who represented the Party of the Regions, which was a more, you know, pro-Russian-speaking regime. And it was always going to be tricky to balance the interests of the two separate groups. But of course, what happened in 2014 is a disorderly coup orchestrated by the West. Anybody who says otherwise is talking absolute rubbish. And of course, it began with the massacre in the Maidan Square, which we now know from the court case in Kiev in 2018 was carried out by a death squad brought in from outside the country, from Georgia and Lithuania, which means it wasn't just inside Ukraine that was doing it. It must have been NATO intelligence.
Some people
services.
Are suggesting there were British weapons used as well.
I think that's quite likely. There was an American officer in charge of the operation. All of this came out at the trial of the Bear Court Riot Police in 2018.
Black operations or special operations using special forces. You know.
Yeah, well, it's basically false flag terrorism.
Yeah.
And of course, this
state
led to
terrorism, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's orchestrated by NATO intelligence services. We've got a track record of doing this going back to the 1940s.
Okay. So,
and working with the right wing in the Ukraine as well. So there's a long history.
The far right.
A far right, yes. Stepan Bandera, the leader of the Banderites, was eventually assassinated. He was extracted from Ukraine by NATO, and he was eventually assassinated by the KGB in Munich in 1959. So the relationship between the far right in the Ukraine and NATO intelligence services is intimate, and it goes back a long way.
I do wonder how much of the $5 billion that Victoria Nuland admitted the State Department through various means, and I suppose there would possibly be more.
That's just the overt means.
Yeah, right. How much of that actually went to these Nazi battalions?
Well, what's happened since 2014 is that British special forces have been training and arming these extreme right formations. And in fact, British military personnel, I believe, have been captured in Azovstal because they're embedded with the Azov battalion.
I think to understand Britain as well, but particularly Ukraine, you've got to understand the oligarchy and these particular oligarchs like Kolomoisky and Viktor Pinchuk.
Yeah, I mean, Ukraine had a very oligarchic, 1990s, very similar to what went down in Russia.
So these were basically newcomers, newbies in 1990, were they, at the beginning of the
90s? Well, what happened is the privatisation of the existing infrastructure at knock-down prices created overnight a class of extremely wealthy people.
Alex Craner talking about something like, was it, I think he said 17 oligarchs actually being trained in Switzerland, being given access to massive amounts of Swiss money in order to basically buy up these distressed assets, which were the state industries of the old Soviet Union.
That's right, and the same sort of thing was going on in Russia and in the Ukraine, but Russia, of course, pulled out of this suicidal direction of policy, and of course they, for example, Gazprom, Rosneft and so on are still owned by the Russian state. Mm. And that, of course, actually allows the Russian state to make plans for what they want to do with their country. Whereas in Ukraine, that's no longer the case.
No, it's a similar system in China, isn't it? Which is what Michael Hudson was pointing out last week, The Economist. Anyway, look, let's look at particularly, because I was quite fascinated by this guy, Viktor Pinchuk, who's supposed to be the grand master of these Ukrainian Freemason lodges behind the coup and also a very powerful figure. He's got something, Martin, he calls the Viktor Pinchuk Foundation. This is a bit sort the Gates like Welcome Foundation like and he likes to use this to appear himself and to have a sort of hand-picked list of guests, the sort of people you might expect, like a General Petraeus and one of the heads of one of the ex-heads of the Central Intelligence Agency. Viktor Pinchuk himself here, we're going to hear from him now, speaking at the Munich Security Conference, which happened in February this year, just before the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians. Well, it's not a normal invasion. They call it a special military operation. But, Martin, explain. This Munich Security Conference has become quite an important annual event, hasn't it? And it's mostly run by the NATO countries, of course.
Yes, and at one stage, Russia was actually suing, saying, can we join NATO? And Putin came to the 2007 Munich conference saying, look, you're going to have to change your attitude here. We're not going to play ball unless you listen to the kind of things we want. And that was a big turning point, because up to that point, Putin had been regarded as a safe pair of hands in the West. He'd stopped the Communist Party taking over in 1998, which was all to the good as far as the West was concerned. But he was also, because of his Russian nationalist credentials, he wasn't prepared to do what the West wanted. And from that point onwards, the West decided that he was a wrong and they were going to get rid of it.
You're reminding me about the Labour leader John Smith at the Bilderberg Conference. I think it was 1991, because there he was quite annoyed with their analysis of the world economy. And he said, oh, no, I don't think I think I want to bring one of my economic analysts, potentially, we don't know, but he was possibly talking about Brian Gould there, to give you a lecture on how to really run the economy. Now, the fact of the matter is, these people want to run the economy for their benefit. They're not interested in running a normal industrial economy, are they?
No, well, I mean, Michael Hudson's very good on this. The financialization of the Western economies has undermined the industrial aspect of the economy in the West.
Isn't it just gangsterization, really? It's just people doing acquiring wealth for their own purposes,
well,
it's
called in economics textbooks rent-seeking. And, you know, a certain amount of rent seeking is, you know, you can't get rid of it completely. A certain amount of speculation is part of, you know, you can't get rid of that completely.
But
if you make rent seeking and speculation the basis of your policy, ultimately you're sawing off the branch you're sitting on. I mean, this is unproductive wealth creation. It doesn't actually produce anything worthwhile apart from the money in the pockets of the people who are doing it.
But this sounds a little bit like this World Economic Forum. You'll own nothing and be happy. You have to rent everything off of us.
Well, I mean, people on the right have picked up on this, you will own nothing and be happy, because they seem to think it's an anti-private property thing. Ultimately, the World Economic Forum represents billionaires. And, of course, they're not saying that they're going to hand over their wealth and that they're going to own nothing, are they? So, in other words, this is a bit of a diversion.
I don't think so. It's quite a good way to impoverish everybody by basically putting up fuel prices, putting up interest rates and mortgage repayments. You're basically driving people into the ground.
Well, ultimately, speculation and rent seeking is unproductive. Mm. And if you allow it to become the dominant feature of your economy will implode. That is exactly what is happening. But of course, both the Russians and the Chinese have taken a different road, and their road is clearly going to work because they have the speculation and rent seeking both in Russia and China. Let's not kid ourselves.
So, anyway,
but the policy is to try and squeeze it out.
Let's go back to early February this year, before the invasion of Ukraine, to hear this, finding fascinating. This mover and shaker of the coup, etc., working for the United States. Also, by the way, a dual Israeli-Ukrainian citizen, Viktor Pinchuk, talking about, what he's saying here is, we must be ready for the invasion. We really think there might be an invasion anytime soon. Of course, what was actually going on, as I heard on the PM program with Evan Davis yesterday.
I spoke to Vladimir Chizov, the Russian ambassador to the EU.
Well, of course, this operation is not without cost. Let me stress that Russia and its president didn't have much of a choice. We had ample evidence. This has been proven by the documents seized in the newly liberated areas of the intention of the Ukrainian armed forces, the Kiev regime, to launch an offensive operation against Donbass. And actually... The date was set for the 8th of March, which is the International Women's Day.
They've got all the evidence now. They were planning to attack the whole of the Donbass region, the Ukrainian army, with support of NATO from afar, on the 3rd of March. So how could the Russians not act?
Well, I totally agree with that. And in any case, people may dispute that, but they can't dispute the fact that the bulk of the Ukrainian army is where it is because they were planning an attack. They wouldn't be there otherwise. They weren't defending Kiev, were they? And that's the problem. And of course, they were shelling away, weren't they?
In fact, they've been shelling away for the last 8 years. Almost like gunnery into housing estates.
That's right, yeah. And of course, the policy really of the Azov battalion and other more extreme elements is to kill or drive out the Russian speaking population. They want the land, but not the people. Mm. Very similar to the way the Croatians pushed the Serbs out of Krajina, which was officially part of Croatia, but the Serbs have been living there for thousands of years, and they were all driven out in one go.
So where was the Nazi Party formed?
Where was the Nazi Party formed? In Germany, Tony.
In Munich. Anyway, let's go to the Munich Security Conference now and have a listen to from the Viktor Pinchuk Foundation. Here he is as part of something called the Yalta European Strategy Group, which he set up with his foundation, explaining to everyone, this is before the Russian invasion, how steely the Ukrainians are prepared to die defending their country, well, the country that he virtually owns.
A few days ago, exactly on the 16th of February, the date which was predicted as a most probable day of Russian invasion into Ukraine, we, as a board of Yalta European Strategy, with my fellow board members, Alexander Kwasniewski, Kirsty Kolylite, Carl Bill, Stefan Fuchs, we visited eastern Ukraine, Dnipropetrovsk city, just 200 kilometers from line of the contact. We met with the students, with the local authorities, with the workers on different steel factories. And we asked them, what do you think, what we have to tell to people in Munich Security Conference, your main message, what they, this is like a summary. Here is what they said. We will fight first. We're tense, but we don't panic. We don't believe really it will happen, but if it happens, we are ready. And we do count on your, Europe's and the West's strong and full support. We hope you feel your responsibility. This is our message for Munich. Look, already 5 years we host this, our Ukrainian lunch. But this conference mainly, unfortunately, mainly about Ukraine. That's why I can call this conference Munich Ukrainian Security Conference. And that's why I cannot call this lunch as Ukrainian lunch. Just to make it simple, this is lunch break during our Munich Ukrainian Security Conference. We have many great friends, many very, very interesting speakers. Thank you very much for your support. Our moderator, I think we were lucky, we have fantastic moderator, Zani Menton-Bidas. She's chief editor of The Economist. Zani, where are you? Floor is yours. Thank you.
So, to moderate his little discussion he's just introduced there, he's got the chief editor of The Economist.
Yeah, well, this is the kind of people that turn up to the Munich Security Conference, isn't it? I mean, it used to actually have, at one stage, as I say, Russian participation, but they, you know, they don't hardly bother.
But this is also Bilderberg. Bilderberg, the chief people from The Economist, the chief editors of there, always were at the Bilderberg conferences. So there they are, walking all around and moderating this ridiculous discussion about how terrible it would be if Russia did anything about the shelling that he doesn't mention that they're doing against the Donbass.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Minsk agreements from 2014 and 2015 were agreed to by Kyiv and also by, you know, backed by the Germans and the French because they were losing the fighting in the Donbass. They'd attacked the independent republics, but they were losing, and therefore they agreed to a ceasefire. And of course, the Donbass Republic's leadership were not really happy with that because they were winning by that stage and they'd already taken a load of punishment.
But there's been a whole load of black operations in there too,
oh,
hasn't
yes,
there?
It has, yes.
You know, assassinations and that kind
That's
of
right.
thing.
That's right, Zakachenko, who's the leader of the Donetsk Republic, I think, he was killed in a car bomb attack.
Yeah.
And all, as were Givi and Motorola, who were paramilitary leaders. Now, there's supposedly a ceasefire, but at the same time, the SBU, the Ukrainian Secret Services, are assassinating both political and military figures inside the Donbass. You know, and if people in the West think it's okay to kill the Prime Minister of the Donbass, Zakachenko, the elected Prime Minister, and they say, okay, that's fine, you think that's an act of war. So when Biden and Johnson are popped off, that's an act of war too, isn't it? It's not a war crime.
Well, maybe it
it's just an act of war.
Maybe it won't be reported like Zakachenko's death was.
Well, it was. Yeah, but it was reported in Russia, of course. Mm. And this is the problem. You see, you've got a totally
different.
It's not
different reported. It didn't happen. It's almost like there's a kind of myopia here, where they deliberately don't want to look at stuff. And I suppose that's in the wider problems there is in journalism, reflected in what's happened to Julian Assange. But let's move on to the next clip from the Munich Security Conference just before the invasion of Ukraine, and here is Dmitry Kuleva. He's the Ukrainian foreign minister at the Munich Security Conference, who was also introduced by Viktor Pinchuk and his little panel, talking about preparations they were making for the Russian invasion.
We now have Dmitry Kuleva, the Ukrainian foreign minister. Thank you for taking time from what I imagine is an incredibly packed couple of hours. Could you give us well, two things. First, your immediate sense of where things are going. And secondly, for this audience, what would you like the West to do?
Yes, hello to everybody. Enjoy your meals. Thank you for having me here. I'm happy to see some friends, some colleagues. It is true that the situation deteriorates every hour. The latest is the fake statements by the Russian Federation that two Ukrainian shells, fell in the territory of Russia, around 101 kilometer away from the Russian-Ukrainian border. We were not shooting. These are not our shells. This is the last thing that we would be interested to see to further escalate the situation. We still are focused on mobilizing diplomacy and taking every opportunity that diplomacy gives to us to prevent further escalation. But of course, in the end, it all depends on the goodwill of Russia, and it's Russia who has to demonstrate that goodwill. I came here from a meeting with G7 foreign ministers. I also had a meeting with Secretary of State. We exchanged information, and they asked me the same question, what the West should do. And my response is that you have the toolkit in your hands. The package of sanctions was prepared. You have weapons which you can share with Ukraine to strengthen our defense. You have financial resources to help us keep our economy running, because, of course, one of the goals that Russia pursues is to shatter us from inside and destabilize our economy, our financial system. active diplomacy must not stop.
So that's the Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmitry Kuleva speaking at the Munich Security Conference, Munich being the town, the lovely little city where the Nazi Party was formed. Also, the European, one of the big European projects was formed there too. Martin, he's really saying that we've got to negotiate, we must take every opportunity for diplomacy before this turns to war.
Well, it's extraordinary, really, because in actual fact, since 2015, when they signed the Minsk agreements, the Ukrainian government has refused to negotiate with the breakaway republics completely. They were saying at one stage that they wanted to talk directly to Putin, but the Russian Federation said, no, it's not us you've got to negotiate with, you've got to negotiate with your own citizens.
He's saying the absolute opposite of what you've just said. We want to have a negotiation. Yes, the last thing in the world we would think of doing would be to lob shells into Russia.
Well, the fact is that the OSCE, which in fact had been infiltrated, it looks like, by Ukrainian intelligence services, they were clear before they were removed from the situation at the beginning of hostilities, recent hostilities, that there was a massive increase in shelling coming from the Ukrainian side. And in any case, it's quite clear, why have the Ukrainians been building up a massive force on the border with the breakaway republics? Yeah, What's the point of it?
Let's not forget the 15,000 people killed over the last 8 years in that particular area. Isn't it interesting the way that, you know, you can have a view which is so missing all the key details? And I suppose that's why they feel that they've had to block out Russia Today and Press TV and these other channels.
Well, that's right. As I was hinting earlier, one of the problems in this crisis, from an objective point of view, is that the Russian population, their media is about as free as our media. It's an equal and opposite thing. So they've heard all of this stuff that we've been talking about. That's been on their TV news every night. So that's their perception of the crisis. But if you were to ask the ordinary punters in the street here about what it's about, they wouldn't know any of that, because it's certainly not reported. I mean, just in recent times, the assassination of Kiryev, who was the first negotiation between the Ukrainian government and the Russian side, took place after the special military operation began, and they met in Belarusia for the first time since 2014, and some progress was made, and then they went back to Kiev, and the first thing that happened is Kiryev, who was one of the delegates on the Ukrainian side, was shot dead by the SBU, which is the Ukrainian secret police. No trial, nothing, just shot dead. He was a traitor. Now, I presume that's because he was actually trying to talk, you know, like, what can we do to bring this conflict to an end? Mm. And the Russians have been keen to talk always.
Yeah.
They've been talking all the time.
Maybe
what's happened now with Boris Johnson and others, they've given up talking.
Maybe he just made the gang boss look stupid in the middle of the negotiations.
Well, I think what you've got is that the far right in the Ukraine do not want a solution. Zelensky was elected specifically on I will talk to the Russians' ticket, which is why he had such a successful election.
But then he's told, if you do that, you're dead.
That's right. Yeah. He then went to the Western powers and said, look, I want to negotiate with the Russians, but the right wing are threatening to kill me if I do. Will you back me up? And they said, no.
Anyway.
We support the right wing. And at that point, Zelensky threw in the towel and decided he was going to have to fight.
Yeah, but he's very much enthusiastic, isn't he? He doesn't seem to be remembering all those promises he made. Look, the final clip from the Munich Security Conference in the first couple of weeks of February this year, just before the Russians invaded. I mean, I just found it interesting to listen to all these people, you know, kind of getting ready for the war, because they clearly think it's coming. Of course, the Americans were there too. And you're going to hear now from US congressman or senator, whatever he is, I'm not sure, Dan Sullivan from Alaska, because he is wanting this panel at the Victor Pinchuk Foundation panel over lunch to explain what to do about Russia and China, because of course he's seeing Ukraine is just a symptom of a much wider problem that we need to sort out.
Longer term, what should we be doing about this broader challenge that is posed by both Russia and China, who are increasingly working together? Of course, we have alliances. Of course, we have our democratic values. We have energy. And we need stronger militaries, in my view. But I would love the question to be directed at the panel on that topic.
Thank you, Senator. It is a very large question that you have asked, but if I could ask perhaps Anne Applebaum and Minister Linder to give very brief responses, because there are many more people who would like to speak here too. Anne.
My very brief response is that we need to eliminate the means by which kleptocrats and autocrats around the world launder their money and spread their influence through our own political systems. That means eliminating money laundering. That means changing the banking system and the legal system so that they can't use anonymous companies to buy property in Western countries and in the United States, including in some American states that have rules like that. Eliminating that will also help eliminate the political influence that they have within our systems. And once we've done that, we can talk about other kinds of efforts, which I'm sure other members of the panel can speak to.
Well, I thought that was quite an interesting answer from Anne Applebaum there. So she's saying, really, look, the main problem is that the Russian and Chinese influence is able to influence our political system through crime and through the ease of money laundering in London and Washington. I mean, it's quite an interesting answer to the question, what are we going to do about Russia and China?
Well, I think that at one stage, the Western powers were quite happy for money laundering from Russia and China, Russia in particular, to take place. There was a huge capital flight, and the oligarchy, basically, you know, empowered by Western advisors like Jeffrey Sachs and local agents like Chubais and Gaidar, they basically looted the Russian
economy.
Well,
we're taking our cut, aren't we? We're saying, of course, you can launder your money.
That's right. And then, of course, they turn around and say, oh, gosh, look how corrupt the oligarchy in Russia is. It's like, well, yes, but you put them in place. The only thing they don't like, they'd have got no problem with oligarchs laundering money. I mean, a lot of this stuff about controlling money laundering is actually because the Panama Papers, for example, and stuff about the Virgin Islands, Nevada and Biden's home state of Delaware are becoming major money laundering centers. So what the US policy is to badmouth money laundering centers elsewhere in the world and go, psst, you want to launder your money? you know where to go. And Hudson's very good about this. So the money, the US rhetoric about getting rid of money laundering elsewhere in the world is to make sure that if you want to launder your money, you've got to do it through the US.
It was a brilliant talk with Ben Norton. I think it's called Multipolar World Podcast, although Ben does tend to ask questions which are far too long. And I've done a version with most of his questions edited out. We had also had some problems with Radio 4All last week, so I just might also say something about that briefly. If anybody has problems downloading the MP3s for the show, listening live is fairly easy, but if you're having problems, please do just look at the time you're trying to download the MP3, maybe take some screenshots and email them to me. My email address, tony@cultureshop, S-H-O-P for Peter, .org.uk, and I will send them on to David Josephson and Tim Pozar at Radio 4All, who can see what's going on, because we had a lot of problems last weekend with the files, which, you know, people were trying to, I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds more downloads than usual, something like 800 people trying to download, but you know what people are trying to do is try and download it, but it wasn't there. The other thing I always try and do nowadays more so is to make sure the show is up there on BitChute. If it's not up on it's almost impossible to put it up on YouTube, because you know, YouTube just say, or you're breaking our various, you know, guidelines or whatever, and so there will, that's a way around this, I guess. But the main thing is, please, let's help the Radio 4All people, because they've got a new architecture for their website about a month and a half ago, and they are having problems with it, so we can help them by feeding back whatever it is, you know, difficulties you're having, and particularly timings, things like that, help them to find out what's causing this and to stop it. So anyway, last week's show, which you may not have been able to download, I don't know, I thought it was this terrific interview with Michael Hudson by Ben Norton. We're gonna have another clip of it this week. And here he is kind of just launching into the beginning of the podcast. We had a section from the middle of it. It's about an hour and 20 minutes long. It goes, if you get rid of Ben's questions, it goes down to about 50 minutes or so. And this is really looking at his new book, Michael Hudson, the great Michael Hudson, author of Killing the Host and various other marvelous books, on economics, real economics, not like the correspondence that we see on the TV talk about, but real economics. And the book is about the decline of the dollar. And it's, isn't it called finance capitalism?
It's called
industrial capitalism or socialism.
Yeah,
or
the future, socialism. The future of civilization.
That's it. Yeah, brilliant book, brilliant man, and yeah, just, you'll just have to indulge me having another clip this week from Michael Hudson, because he explains it all. You know, everything.
Well, the book came out of a series of 10 lectures that I did for my Chinese audience. I've been a professor at Peking University for a number of years. In economics, and have professorships at other universities, Wuhan and Hong Kong. And I have a fairly large audience of about 65,000 people for lecture there. And I was asked to give my general overview, sort of a history of economic development in the West for the Chinese. And in order to understand today's finance capitalism, you have to understand what industrial capitalism was, as it was described in the 19th century. And it's often forgotten or played down that industrial capitalism was revolutionary. What it was trying to do, from the physiocrats in France in the late 18th century to Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, Marx, and the whole late 19th century flowering of socialism, the ideal of classical value theory and rent theory was to say, what is the actual value, the cost value of producing goods and services, and what is earned by the capitalist and when he employs labor to make a profit, and what is unearned? And what's unearned was the landlord class, that was the hereditary warrior class that had conquered all of the European kingdoms in the Middle Ages. And the attempt by England's industrialists was saying, look, we cannot become the workshop of the world. We cannot undersell foreign countries if we have a landlord class raking off all of the money in land rent, and if we have predatory banking where the wealthy people just lend really for buying property or making distress loans or predatory loans that have nothing to do with financing actual capital formation. Well, what made this capitalism revolutionary was the British industrialists and advocacy of industry. Even the bankers in Ricardo's time said, well, in order to overthrow the landlord class, which controls the House of Lords and all of the upper chambers of government in Europe, we have to have democratic reform. If we have democratic reform and give voting to the people, they're going to vote against the landlord class, and then we can have an efficient economy where our prices of our exports and our goods and services reflect the actual cost of production, not the rake-off for the rentier class, not the rake-off of what landlords take, not the rake-off of what predatory bankers take. And the whole long 19th century leading up to World War One was this revolutionary value theory that depicted land rent and monopoly rent and financial returns as being unearned income and wanting to strip it away. And all of this seemed to be moving towards socialism. The industrialists were all in favor of government public utilities, of government enterprise, because they said if the government doesn't provide health care, then individuals are going to have to pay it, and it'll cost a lot of money, like it does in the United States. And so you had the conservative prime minister of England, Benjamin Disraeli, saying, health, all is health, we've got to provide public health for the people. And it was the conservative Bismarck in Germany that says, we've got to provide pensions. If labor has to save up for the pensions, then it's not going to have enough money to buy the goods and services that we Germans are producing. We've got to make pensions public. So all of this move towards socialism was not only in favor of increasing living standards, which soared in the 19th century, but also in freeing economy from the rentier class, from the landlords, from the bankers. And for the classical economist, a free market was a market free from landlords, free from bankers, free from monopolists. Well, needless to say, the rentiers fought back. And by after World War II, we've seen a continual anti-classical theory, replacing the classical idea of free markets with a value-free theory, saying, well, everybody earns whatever they have. All wealth is earned, not unearned. And if Goldman Sachs partners are paid more than anyone else, that's because they're so productive. So you had a move rejecting classical economics to junk economics and a kind of artificial economics that doesn't really talk about how finance capitalism has worked. And as it turns out, the business plan of finance capitalism was so predatory that it was anti-industrial. That's why President Clinton in the United States moved to invite China into the International Labor Organization, saying, well, we can fight wage rises in America by a race to the bottom. We can hire Asians to do work, and that will cause unemployment here, and that's wonderful for the industrialists. It will basically cut wages and keep American wages down. Well, that basically is the strategy of finance capitalism, and the aim of finance capitalism is not to invest in factories and plant and equipment and research and development, but to live in the short term, but to make money by financial engineering, not industrial engineering. And it becomes predatory. And so you have the whole ideological attack on public enterprise. You have Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, where you say if the government provides public health care, that's the road to serfdom, where actually it's finance capitalism that's the road to debt peonage and serfdom. You have now a whole disparagement of government, and all of this is a counter-revolution to the revolutionary impetus of industrial capitalism in its early stages. And it's true that corporations now are just as right-wing as the banks and the hedge funds, but that's because corporate industry has been taken over by the financial sector, and the heads of almost every industrial corporation are rewarded to how high they can push the stock price to exercise the stock options they're paid in. And you increase the stock price not by investing more, not by hiring more labor or increasing productivity or increasing sales, but simply by using whatever income you have to buy back your stocks. And by buying back your stocks, this forces up their price. And most of all, by giving political contributions in this country to the Democrats and Republicans alike to appoint Federal Reserve heads that have spent $7 to $9 trillion buying up stocks and bonds to increase the price of buying a retirement income, to increase Wall Street prices, to increase housing prices, and make America even less competitive industrially. So finance capitalism is what is essentially deindustrialized the United States and turned the Midwest into a rust belt. Well, the alternative, obviously, is our societies that have not followed this neoliberal finance capitalist plan. And the most successful economy, obviously, has been China, which is why I've been spending so much time there. And the obviously, China has done exactly what 19th century United States, Germany, England, and France did. It's kept basic utilities, basic needs, housing, and above all, finance and banking in the public domain as public utilities. Instead of having an independent financial sector operating on its own self-interest, the Bank of China creates the money. And the Bank of China lends money by deciding, where do we need to have investment in real estate to provide housing for the population at as low a price as we can make it? How do we provide, build up the industry? How do we provide an educational system with training? How do we provide health? And you have, the fact is that the central planning in a efficient socialist style, not the Stalinist planning that everybody refers to of Russia, but a mixed economy, as you have in China, which is truly a mixed economy, with guidance, like the French call planification. Well, that is obviously the way in which you survive and you avoid the kind of overloading the economy with debt service, with high rents, with high payments to the healthcare monopoly in the United States, by avoiding all of this payment to a rentier class that has what the classical economists call unearned income, predatory income. And instead of unseating them, we've put them in charge and made the banks and Wall Street and the City of London and the Paris Bourse the central planners. So we do have central planning, much more centralized than anything that was dreamed by the socialists. But the planning, centralized planning, is done by the financial sector. Financial planning is short-termism. It's short-term planning. It's taking your money and run. And that's what is stripping and impoverishing the global economy today.
So he's really not quite about the global economy, is he? I mean, he's talking really there about the Western interests. I love his saying at the end there, actually, we do have central planning. It's just central planning by the banksters.
That's right. In actual fact, the idea that the market just operates and there is no plan, which is the fantasy, isn't the case. There is a plan. It's just an extremely bad one. Put together by people with vested interests who want, they're planning for their own enrichment.
They are, well, why not? That's exactly what these sorts of individuals would be expected to do if they're not regulated and governments don't get a handle on them. But the sort of central planning that they are doing is not really working with the Russians and the Chinese. And what I loved about, I mean, we had the clip last week where he's basically saying there that the war in Ukraine is really a battle of different systems, different ways of doing things. And actually, that's what the Russians have got, one way of doing things. The West has got another way, and they want to impose their will on the other side.
Yeah, I think he's very good about that. It's ultimately a struggle between different conceptions of how to organise the economy. I mean, that was very clear in the first Cold War. And of course, you got, you know, Stalinist central planning leading to famine in the Soviet Union, the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward in China leading to deaths of millions, you know, a huge dead end. But of course, you've now got a much more modernistic mentality, both in China and in Russia. These are modern societies with all the technical capacity that the West has got. And at the same time, they're not turning into free market clones. And that's because, in actual fact, for most countries in the world, the free market policy pursued by the IMF, the World Bank, the Washington Consensus has been disastrous.
But isn't it interesting how the Russians and the Chinese are actually running their economy rather like Britain did in the 1950s and 60s, a mixed economy?
That's right. And, you know, it's absolutely frustrating to me as a 62-year-old that the obvious, that you have a mixture of public and private, with the public obviously dominant because the public interest must overcome the private interest, is common sense. But we've thrown it all out of the window, and there's a huge pseudo science of free market economics which doesn't even take account of the fact of finance capital at all. Mm-hmm. As Steve Keane, the Australian economist, has pointed out, there is no theory of finance. The actual theory in the textbooks, the mainstream textbooks, is that finance is irrelevant.
Yeah.
And of course, it's just nonsense.
What he's saying effectively, well, I mean, he's being specifically saying that the financial institutions have no effect on the economy, that they're basically neutral.
That's right.
Which is just nonsense. They're working for their own self-aggrandizement. Of course they are. Anyway, the book, absolutely essential for anyone to stay on top of the madness, is the economic, well, I mean, Putin called it the empire of lies, didn't he? Really, this is kind of fake consensuses which are made up and then just spewed out across the mainstream press as if they're true. Well, they're not. And of course, the only way that journalists can keep their jobs is by keep repeating the lies. It's appalling. The book is called what is it called again?
The Future of Civilization, Financialization.
No, it's not, no.
What's it called?
Try again.
You've got it in front of me, I'll tell you.
I've got a copy of the cover of the book here. It's The Destiny of Civilization, Finance Capitalism, Industrial Capitalism, or Socialism by Professor Michael Hudson. And I'll put a link to that, obviously, up on our show page. Actually, I'll do the 55-minute version with Ben's questions curtailed, not the 1 hour and 25-minute version, so that's half an hour of questions pretty much I've cut out of there, because I just want to hear what Hudson's got to say. You know, so he asked some very simple questions, Ben Norton, but in a very, very long-winded way. Anyway, so, and I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, the short version, and you'll be able to download that short version too from thisweek.org.uk later. Any problems with downloading or whatever, as I say, just go to the contact tab at thisweek.org.uk and email me and I'll pass it on to the server people. One of the spin-offs of this empire of lies and nonsense in the financial sector, and the journalists finding it impossible to do their job, the media owners, the editors, the managers just managing lies basically rather than doing proper journalism, is this I found fascinating program on the BBC World Service this week. It's called The Advertising Trap, Martin. It turns out that quite a lot of money, in fact most of the money that's spent on internet advertising, is possibly completely ineffective at actually reaching anybody, because there's so much automation on the internet that people who run the advertising services can also, I'm not saying they all do this, but they can commission people to write software which is bots pretending to be people clicking on their ads.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is capitalists stealing from each other, isn't it?
Anyway, let's have a listen to the good old, you know, I feel a bit controversial saying the good old BBC, but this is the sort of programme that you can't have on a commercial broadcaster because they don't want to upset their advertisers, do they?
What about the much vaunted targeting that we hear so much about with new advertising, programmatic advertising? Doesn't it help that advertisers can now reach out and to almost touch the people precisely that they wish to reach with their ads?
Well, of course, anything you can do to get your ads in front of more relevant people is going to have a large effect. However, one of the studies I did, we ask advertising networks to show our ads to men. And then we actually measured whether or not it was men who saw them. And we found that actually the ad was being shown to men around half the time, which, if you think about it, is really quite funny.
So, in other words, she's saying, these supposedly laser-targeted ads were actually no better than random at selecting something as simple as someone's gender. It is funny, perhaps, but it's also kind of terrifying if you're an advertiser. We're going to be looking more at the implications of this in the second half of this show. But for now, let's hear about what this apparently lousy targeting feels like for those paying for the ads. Nandini Jami runs a US watchdog trying to support firms online, but she began her career as a digital marketer for a small British startup, which is when she discovered that the ads were going astray.
I assumed that we would have our ads being placed on CNN or New York Times or NBC News. And instead, what I found was that my ads were appearing on websites I'd never heard of, websites that looked like they had all kinds of weird numbers in them. One website that jumped out at me was a conspiracy theory website. So just not the kind of quality or the kind of websites that my demographic would be engaging with. We did the math later. It was very difficult to sort through and figure out. And I think, and I'm still not sure, we may have gotten two paying customers. We don't even know if they're paying. two customers from this entire campaign. And that means that our campaign cost us £1,500 per customer.
So that's almost $2,000. That sounds like a colossal waste of money.
That's right. And we hooked up our ads to a software that allows us to actually see what users are doing when they log onto our landing page. That is the page you get to when you click on the ad. And we found these arrows like just kind of going dead once the page loaded. And I was like, wow, is my copy that bad? Is this landing page that bad that people just left? And it actually really affected me emotionally. I was like, am I not as good of a copywriter as I thought? And later I realized that it was bots. What was actually happening is a bot was clicking on the ad and then it went dead because the money, you know, the transaction was complete.
So some kind of computerized machine was accessing your ad, clicking on it. For what purpose?
For money. Because advertisers are basically the ATM of the internet. They're the ATM of this entire internet economy. And the entire internet economy is based on advertisers spending a lot of money, more money every year, and not knowing where that money is going.
So that's the advertising trap. I put a copy of the whole show of that. It's actually a fascinating documentary. I think it's about 45, 50 minutes long, looking at as only the BBC or similar organisations which don't take paid advertising can really do, Martin, at just what a load of BS this advertising on the internet industry is. I mean, it's taking money from clients to put adverts out there, and then it's making money from them by creating little bot software that's got nothing to do with human beings at all to pretend to click away on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, advertising, there's a book called Monopoly Capital by Paul Barron and Sweezy, came out in the 60s. Advertising is a barrier to entry. So if you spend a lot of money on advertising, as Coca-Cola say, or, you know, any big name brand, what you are doing is it making it very difficult for other firms to enter that market. So it's a way of trying to create monopolization. And of course, that's the sort of theme in Naomi Klein's book, No Logo, from some years ago now. I mean, advertising is waste, just as financialization leads to waste.
But it's
as
tempting,
well.
Though, isn't it? Because it's tax deductible. You don't pay any corporation tax. All that money, as your profits are eaten into by your advertising, you're paying less and less tax the whole time.
Yeah, obviously, advertisers would like to have more effective advertising rather than less effective advertising. But the point about having to spend the money on advertising means that if you want to move into a market and you want to, you've got to advertise, and that makes it a costly to move into the market. Which means existing players can then control that market. So everybody is seeking oligopoly, monopoly.
Well, do you know what?
And using these techniques in order to get it.
You could even have, say, for example, some big conglomerate owns a marketing advertising internet company like Google, for example. Then you could give preferential rates to certain clients, and they would never know an algorithm which actually serves real adverts at real people rather than just at bots. So there's an enormous amount of power in these advertising companies like Google.
Well, obviously, and of course, what they're looking for is ultimately market power, market control. And of course, as they struggle to gain market power and market control, they are actually eliminating competition.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Yeah, and say, for example, that, you know, you may get Google doing a nice little deal with Microsoft, saying, well, I tell you what, we'll give you loads of free real advertising, whilst all those other punters out there are paying through the nose for advertising which isn't getting anywhere. I mean, this is an enormous amount of power in these kind of advertising.
I think what Michael Hudson would say, well, the logical thing to do is nationalise it all.
Well, yes, and have the board meetings open to public scrutiny, and the minutes open to public scrutiny. Another programme which is on this week, which I found fascinating too, this is, again, I'm really sort of bigging up the BBC World Service this week, is a programme called Digital Planet, which had a fascinating little excerpt. You're going to hear an excerpt now, from some techies who've been closely examining these various things like Zoom and Skype, you know, these online video conferencing apps, that actually when you hit mute, it's still listening to everything you're saying. So that's, I mean, quite clearly, this is a surveillance tool. This is a potential surveillance tool, Martin, isn't it? Rather than it's just a way to have a little chit-chat on the internet or help share. What, you know, if you hit mute, you're assuming wrongly that cuts off the feed from your microphone to the internet and to the app, but it doesn't at all. So that in the world of Microsoft or Zoom or whoever, they can be listening to that, they can be recording it. It's just, it's not being that audio feed or video feed is not being passed on to other people in that particular conversation, but it can easily be recorded and listened to by anyone wanting to use that app for surveillance.
Yeah, and of course, in the past, if you surveyed people to that level, you wouldn't be able to do much with the information because it would just be information overload. But of course, what computers now allow is the analysis of this traffic and other information.
To target ads and things,
yeah,
maybe.
So, yeah. Well, I mean, and, you know, this is surveillance capitalism.
Anyway, I found it fascinating. Let's have a listen to these techies talking about it on Digital Planet on BBC World Service this week. Actually, no, sorry, it's not this week. It was two or three weeks ago.
You're on a conference call, right? And the dog's barking, or the washing machine's going, or basically you just want some privacy. So you mute your mic. Now, sure, others on the call, they can't hear you anymore, but your video conferencing app can. Mute doesn't necessarily mean mute. That's the main message from findings just published in the Proceedings on Privacy Enhancing Technologies. One of the researchers is Professor Kasim Fawaz of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's been telling me about what made him so curious about the issue.
Well, actually, it started with my brother, who was having that video conferencing call, and he was using an iPhone app. He was muted. And then there was this orange button or orange indicator at the corner of the screen that was still on while he was muted. And he's also an engineer and he knows these things. So he got concerned and he knew that something is going on, that the mute button is not really blocking the audio. So he called me and says, well, you need to investigate this. This can be something interesting to look at. And then I spoke with the PhD students in our lab, with our collaborators at Loyola University in Chicago. And then it's like, okay, let's start working on this.
you started by really trying to find out what people's attitudes were, how much people trusted the mute button on their conferencing apps. What did you find from that?
It turns out that there's a lot of people, when they click this mute button, they think that this blocks audio flow to these apps, meaning that the audio doesn't go to these apps anymore. And that was kind of interesting, because our experiments and our results were showing that the audio still flows to these apps, and people do not expect the audio to be flowing to these apps. And here you have a classical case of people's expectations not matching the behavior of the tools they're using. And this was a reason for concern.
What did you do in this research to study all this?
So we wanted to understand if the audio is actually flowing to the app when the user is muted. So we started with this array of video conferencing apps, all the popular ones. We installed them on Windows, on macOS, and on Google Chrome. And we would start a meeting. And during the meeting, the user would actually click the mute button. And at the same time, we have instrumented the audio APIs and the operating systems to understand if the bytes from the microphone are still flowing to the app while the user is muted. In the cases of macOS and in Windows, we found that for all of these apps, regardless of whether you're clicking the mute button or not, the audio data is still flowing to the app, meaning that the app is still processing audio data even when you're muted. Now, we did not find any evidence that this audio data is leaving the device, but the app still has access to this audio data. When you're muted, the audio stream is not blocked.
That's quite a finding. And this is looking at the OS then, looking at the operating system. Are you saying this is independent of the actual app that you might be using? It's more to do with the operating system?
Well, actually, that's a very interesting question. It has to do with both. The way things happen in software, whenever an app wants to access a microphone, it has to request a microphone capability from the operating system. And that operation can take a while. And that can affect user usability, because you don't want to unmute and then wait for 1 second for the audio to start flowing to the other parties on the call. So what happens is they implement a soft mute button functionality. They keep the audio capability, the app, and then when you're muted, they stop the audio flow to the other parties on the call. But they still have audio access because they don't want to give it up. They don't want to give it up. They give it up, then it affects the usability of the app. Now, the problem with the operating system is that they don't provide an easy mute toggle for the apps, and they don't provide an easy mute toggle for the users. Like, as a user, if I would like to mute, Windows or macOS doesn't provide a readily used tool by which I can just mute the button. For example, if I'm using a camera, I can just put a shield on the camera. I can cover my camera and no one will see me. Such a thing doesn't exist for a microphone.
So very simply, the operating system is the thing that links things like your microphone, your camera, your keyboard into whatever app is sitting on the operating system. And what you're saying is that at the OS level, typically anyway, there's no on and off toggle for the mic. So it relies on the app, the video conferencing app itself, sitting on the operating system to have an effective way of muting.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And that's not the case for all operating systems. Now, if you look at, for example, browsers like Google Chrome, which is effectively an operating system, if you're running a video conferencing app on Google Chrome, which you can look at it as an app running on a smaller operating system, there is a soft mute button functionality there. If you mute yourself while using Google Chrome on a video conferencing app, Google Chrome will actually start sending the apps just like an empty byte stream.
Did you get any insight into whether any of these apps are doing anything with it? Or is it just like an accident of the operating system, basically, that the audio happens to get there?
No, it was not an accident. They have legitimate functionality of why they want to do this. For example, everyone who has used one of these popular video conferencing apps, they have noticed that when they're muted and they're trying to talk, it will give them the warning, hey, you're muted. So how would that app know that you're muted? That means that they are analyzing the speech. And there they can say, well, we're just doing some simple energy detection to help user functionality. Sure. I mean, they are doing this. In some cases, like in the case of Cisco WebEx, we found that they are processing the data and they're sending audio telemetry data every minute, even when you're muted. And this telemetry data is just like average, minimum, and maximum noise level in the room while you're muted every 1 minute. So there's some processing happens, and I have to say Cisco stopped doing this after our disclosure. But apps still analyze the data, they can still process it, and we can't really know what processing they are doing with the audio data that's flowing through them. But we didn't find any evidence of anything nefarious going on.
That's Kasim Fawaz, who, by the way, has also done research on voice assistants. I'm sure many of us are interested in that. We have them in our homes, some of us. And you can hear that in the extended version of this programme on BBC Sounds or you can download the podcast and you'll hear more Qasem and other such goodies for you. Now then, Bill Thompson is sitting here, and listening to that piece, Bill, you're kind of doing your I'm not surprised face. Did I read your gestures correctly there?
You did, actually. That's very intuitive of you. Very, very good of you to intuit that. Yes, I mean, in a sense, of course the microphone's not turned off. Or rather, it's soft turned off, and is available at various levels of the operating system into the application, just to give the sort of functionality that Qasem was talking about, you know, to know that you're saying something and looking like a fool on Zoom because everybody can see your lips move. So that seems reasonable. I think what's interesting was, in their research, they found the expectations of people about what was happening when they muted were different from the reality, and it's always that difference in expectation and what's going on that creates a space within which people can be, you know, annoyed, upset, surprised, whatever.
So that's the BBC's Digital Planet there, and interesting to have that guy come in at the end basically making excuses for the saying, well, people might expect that, but that's just because they're a little bit stupid. No, I think if you want to mute it, you want to mute it. And he made the point there that a lot of these apps, Martin, will tell you you are muted if it picks you up your microphone and you've got the mute on. And if you're trying to speak, it thinks you've accidentally muted yourself and you need to unmute yourself. So anyway, I just think it's just more and more coming out about just how useful the internet is for surveillance. So the idea is you hook up to the internet, but the deal is the internet is hooking into you.
Yeah, and of course people carry around their computers with them in their pockets as a smartphone. In 1984, people were forced to watch the TV in their homes in the novel, and then they could hide behind a corner to avoid being watched because the TV was watching them. But of course people these days go out and spend good money on buying a smartphone, which means that you're constantly being surveyed by the state and by the corporation.
That's right. And it's interesting that the microphones on these smartphones, particularly probably the other, the other types of non-smart mobile phones as well, are constantly listening. It's quite clear if you look on certainly my experience is, you find that all sorts of interesting things pop up on your newsfeed, which is maybe something you were talking about the previous day near the phone. And this, of course, is something that nobody has actually consented to listening in and targeting ads at you based on what you're saying when your phone is just in your pocket or you think it's on a shelf and you're not using it.
Yes, and of course it's not just people trying to sell you washing powder who are listening. In what's going on in the Ukraine, I understand that Ukrainian soldiers are allowed to keep their phones, but they're not supposed to use them except when they're on, you know, rest and recreation or whatever, but that the Russian military, more professionally, they're just not allowed to carry phones at all because, of course, you can be traced by using a phone, etc.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? The idea is that maybe the Ukrainian army are just kind of keeping an eye on everybody and are keeping an eye on morale through
their
phone.
The things that they've just passed a law, I believe, in Kyiv, that officers have got the right to shoot anybody who tries to desert or surrender or whatever. That's because a lot of people are surrendering.
You mean they don't want to fight for the Russians and die?
Well, the situation is dire. Don't forget the Ukrainian army is a largely conscript army, apart from the paramilitary battalion, like the Azov battalion. They are committed volunteers. The Russian army, on the other hand, is largely, it's a professional army. They are, you know, full-time soldiers. And, you can see the difference in the way they can, you know, obviously there's a technological difference, but it's also an organisational difference between the two sides.
Okay, so I'm going to have a look at the Rich List and Leveller's Day after we've heard some of the basic stuff from Prime Minister's Questions this week about the cost of living crisis. Do you want to just give us your take on it before we hear from Boris and Starmer, Martin?
Well, obviously the big news of the week is that the government has crumbled. We were discussing this last week.
Many weeks we've been saying, Are they going to do it? Rishi Sunak might be going to do this, and it looks as if Rishi has won the day and he's going to have a windfall tax. Well, we're not allowed to call it a windfall tax.
No, well, I mean, in any case, it is obviously welcome that they have done what was blindingly obvious. But of course, the other thing that they could have done if they wanted to is just not let the oil and gas companies increase their prices, because the prices are administered anyway. It's not a free market price. Off gas, etc. They set the price. Now, ultimately, if you're going to set the price, you might as well run the industry. And of course, in some countries, that is the case. In France, for example.
There's a very basic bit of analysis, which is not being done, I think, by any of the mass media, which is that if the only reason there's a windfall for the oil and gas companies is because they aren't profiteering. I mean, there's no reason why they should have excess profits.
If you were if they regulated them properly, then they wouldn't have excess profits.
Well, what they've done is they've used the global situation, particularly with the Russian sanctions, as an excuse to put up the price of everything as a price fix, basically, and just put these prices up. There's no discussion about that really at all, is there? The fact that you've got these excess profits that they've just decided they want to make. It could be quite easy if these were decent companies, which they're clearly not, to just literally, if the oil price or gas price is going up, literally track that and charge a little bit more to the consumers. But they've been using it as an opportunity to charge the consumers massive amounts more and increase their margins.
Yes, but Electricité de France, owned by the French state, hasn't done that at all, because there's no reason for them to do it. I think, you know, you could administer the prices, or you could actually run it yourself. And of course, Gazprom is turning into it, and Rosneft for the Russians, which are state-owned firms like Statoil in Norway. I mean, I saw the Poles were complaining that the Norwegians were making excessive profits and that they wanted to be given some money to tide them over. And of course, it's like, well, you know, that's the free market, matey. You know, that's the price. And if you can't pay it, you can't have it.
Because part of that Michael Hudson discussion, he's explained how actually even the term free market economics has been usurped by the rentiers to mean we can do what we want. No, it's not supposed to mean that. It's supposed to mean free market economics is supposed to mean that you've got various of the utilities that have to be paid throughout society, things like gas, water, etc., transport, being provided at cost. And so what you've done is you've allowed your industry and anyone that's providing goods and services to be operating almost at cost, so they don't have these massive overheads. As soon as you start privatizing, as Margaret Thatcher and Victor Rothschild were doing in the 1980s, you create this massive racketeering class that are just sitting there playing golf whilst everybody, you know, they're making their money out of everyone's basic needs to get around and their fundamental needs every day.
Well, also, it undermines competitive, export-oriented industry.
Destroys your economy, as he says. Well, Hudson. Anyway, Michael Hudson, sorry, I'm going on and on and on about him, but that was such a brilliant interview he gave, I thought, with his new book, you know. And, of course, the end result is, let's just do things like Britain did in the 1950s and 60s. It's a bit of a no-brainer. Anyway, OK, Prime Minister's questions, cost of living crisis, social care, Boris and Keir.
Mr. Speaker, last week I raised the case of Phoenix Halliwell, whose kidney condition means he needs daily dialysis and whose energy bill has gone through the roof as a result. I'm glad that as a result government officials got in touch with Phoenix yesterday, and I hope that will result in more support for people who are vulnerable. But it shouldn't be left to Labour to turn up week after week to make him aware of the consequences of his dither and delay. So I want to raise another issue where the government is sleepwalking into disaster. With the summer holidays looming, there are reports that the Home Office already has a backlog of 500,000 passports to issue. That's potentially more than 500,000 people worrying whether they will get away this summer. So can the Prime Minister reassure people that they won't miss out on their holidays due to the failures of his Home Office?
Prime Minister! Well, I thank you very much, but I can tell him, actually, that what we're doing is massively increasing the speed with which the Passport Office deliver. And to the best of my knowledge, everybody is getting their passport within 4 to 6 weeks, Mr. Speaker. But that is because we are driving the leadership of this country, and we are getting things done that would never have been possible if we'd listened to them. We got Brexit done, Mr. Speaker, when he voted 48 times. 48 times he voted to undo the will of the people. We got the vaccine rollout done when he would have kept in the European Medicines Agency, Mr. Speaker. We were the first European country to help the Ukrainians resist Vladimir Putin. Yes. Do you think, does anybody seriously believe for a second that they would have done it?
Some are trying to boo, some are trying to cheer. The worst of it is, I can't hear the Prime Minister. Come on, Prime Minister.
Let me say very plainly, does anybody seriously think for a second that the Labour Party would have done that, Mr. Speaker, with eight of the shadow front bench, including the shadow foreign secretary, who is mysteriously not in his place, voted recently to get rid of this country's independent nuclear deterrent? And he campaigned to put Jeremy Corbyn in Downing Street, Mr. Speaker. We get on, we do the difficult things. We do the difficult things. We take the tough decisions, Mr. Speaker. Social care, we're fixing it.
So there's an enormous kind of shouts, jeer, you know, they're both sides shouting at each other at the end there, Martin. But the questions are serious from Keir Starmer. He does quite a good job with these questions, but Boris just kind of hedges around all over the place, doesn't he, without any kind of anything you can pin him down on.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've got pretty much used to his style by now.
We got Brexit done. Okay, yeah. Now, how long ago was that? Let's talk about the cost of living crisis. It's not even necessarily true,
because, of course, the Iron Patriot College is still in place.
Which we'll be moving on to next. But, I think the basic Labour Party attitude to all of this seems to be, let's just do it slightly different to the Conservative Party. It's definitely not a kind of Corbynista attitude now, is it, from Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor?
No, well, you can see that the faction that is now in charge of Labour policy do not have radical goals. Their idea is to take power and to manage the existing setup a bit better. And in fact, you know, you can see why they might think that, because society is quite a conservative structure. It's difficult to change things, and it's often easier to just tinker rather than go for big, world beating changes, as it were. But of course, the crisis in international capitalism and international geopolitics is going to make that kind of parochialism irrelevant as we go forward.
Well, you've been talking about economic crash for a long time. I mean, that may come, mightn't it, when we start getting interest rates going up,
absolutely,
people can't afford to pay their mortgages. Another kind of subprime crash.
Yes, well, I mean, there's so many ways in which a crash could occur that it's almost baked in. But don't forget that the people who buy and sell stocks and shares have got a vested interest in talking up what they're doing, because they want you to buy stocks and shares, which is why they're always completely blindsided by crashes, because obviously they've been telling everybody, buy our shares because they're going to go up in value.
In the meantime, the United Kingdom is being turned into this kind of third world country where all these services that we're paying for in our taxes are just crumbling, and all of the taxes seem to be going either to pet projects like HS2 of the elite, or just to interest, debt and debt repayments. So let's have a listen now to another question before we go to Northern Ireland on the social care failing just down the road here in Wales.
Ben Lake, Mr. Speaker, rising fuel costs are causing serious problems for workers in car-dependent rural areas like Ceredigion, and for carers and district nurses, the situation has reached a crisis point. One carer from Ceredigion often has to travel 29 miles just to reach the first service user of the day, and travels around 1,700 miles each month. Would the Prime Minister therefore consider extending the Rural Fuel Duty Relief Scheme to areas like Ceredigion to help my constituent and many like her to continue their invaluable work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Minister.
I thank him for his excellent question. I can tell him that fuel duty relief is there to compensate motorists by helping retailers in some more remote rural areas where pump prices can be significantly higher. It currently operates on a geographical basis, but Mr. Speaker, I'm very happy to ensure that the Honourable Gentleman gets a meeting with the relevant Minister as fast as possible.
Well, fuel duty relief scheme, I didn't know anything about that, but it just sounds like another way of kind of putting your finger in the dike, because the overall system isn't working. And so as services collapse, governments like maybe the Welsh government, for example, are having to put these kind of patches like this scheme on there in order to allow basic services to be still delivered.
Well, I think we're all living on borrowed time. People probably haven't really understood how serious the crisis is. I mean, people are grumbling, people are aware that they're suffering, but the consequences of a global crash of the kind that we're probably going to have are absolutely terrifying.
Well, are they as terrifying for the Chinese and Russians as they are for people in this part of the world?
That's a very interesting question, Tony, because I read a lot of stuff about this, and obviously the Russians and the Chinese are trying to insulate themselves from the West's implosion, yeah, insofar as they can. But of course it's not necessarily going to be possible, because the Chinese, for example, they need to sell loads of exports in order to keep their economy running, and that means that if the West collapse, that's going to cause them problems. And similarly with the Russians. I think the Russians in the longer run, because they've got a relatively small population and massive resources, probably will be all right. But the Chinese may find that their property market, for example, again, you've got rent-seeking in China. There's a possibility that that could collapse, and that might bring down the Western. You know, that might be the straw that breaks the camel's back. But I think the leadership in both Moscow and Beijing are very well aware of their vulnerability, and they're doing everything they can. I mean,
well, Hudson's, they can do a hell of a lot more, can't they? Because they're actually in charge of their own banks.
Well, that's right. And, of course, the sanctions that have been placed on Russia by the West have forced the Russians, and this is since 2014, have forced the Russians to look to their own resources and to cut out as much as they can vulnerability to Western pressure.
Wasn't it interesting that the analysis we had a couple of weeks ago, that the sanctions against Russia as a result of Ukraine have actually led to the end of the petrodollar, really? I mean,
ended yet, but it's on the way.
So, anyway, the evidence is right in front of our eyes in some of our high streets. So just basically the shops are emptying. This is surely, Martin, to do with the property bubble, isn't it?
Well, the property bubble is still raging away in Britain. I mean, this is the thing about bubbles, everybody would think, well,
this is the rentiers.
Who's
the rentiers?
Who's stupid
Michael
enough
Hudson.
To stay into the last
Michael
to the
Hudson
last,
was talking
the
about
last,
the rentiers,
the last
wasn't
mile.
He?
Yeah.
This is what's the problem, is you can sell stuff and you can make money selling stuff. You just can't pay the rent to do it.
Yes, and
in premises.
It leads to massive distortions in the allocation of capital.
Anyway, let's have a listen to the high streets talked about in Prime Minister's questions again.
We now come to Jonathan Gullis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. High Streets and Heritage means a lot to the people of Stoke-on-Trent North, Kidsgrove and Torque. Burslem and Tunstall, two of the great six towns of Stoke-on-Trent, are plagued with rogue and absent landlords who are too happy to let shops sit empty and historically important buildings such as Price and Kensington Teapot Works fall into ruin, which is why I introduced my proper maintenance of land bill to increase fines on these ruinous owners. Can my right honourable friend confirm that as part of the government's planning reform, he will adopt my bill which imposes a new unlimited fine so these reckless reprobates can be held accountable up the Vale for Saturday, Mr. Speaker?
Prime Minister.
Here, Mr. Speaker. Up the Vale, but I want to thank him, by the way, for his campaign. I think he's entirely right, and that's why we've adopted the measures that he proposes in the bill. Those who leave properties derelict unreasonably could face an unlimited fine, Mr. Speaker.
Well, and could maybe not as well face an unlimited fine. But the point here, Martin, is that people are buying these properties not to rent them out, but just as an investment. So they actually don't want anyone in there. They'd rather just board them up and then in a couple of years maybe sell them for a profit.
Yeah, and this is not economically rational. It's misallocation of resources. And this is the fundamental problem with all of it.
OK, on to the Northern Ireland Protocol now.
Sir Geoffrey Donaldson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was pleased to meet the Prime Minister last week in Royal Hillsborough in my constituency. We welcome his commitment to introduce legislation to deal with the protocol and the Irish Sea border and to protect the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. That will take some time. In the meantime, as in the rest of the United Kingdom, hard-pressed households in Northern Ireland are suffering from the cost of living crisis. Will the Prime Minister give me an assurance that any measures that are brought forward by the Chancellor in the near future to help hard-pressed households will apply to Northern Ireland, and that the protocol will not be allowed to prevent Northern Ireland citizens receiving the support they need from the government at this time?
I thank the right honourable gentleman very much. As he knows, we have a package of measures to support families across the whole of the UK that I've detailed already to the House. I may say that I also think it would be an advantage to the people of Northern Ireland in tackling the issues that we all face across the UK if Stormont were to be restored, Mr. Speaker.
Well, what Geoffrey Donaldson is saying there is, are we going to get the same windfall tax handouts and so on as the rest of the UK? And of course they are. The protocol's got nothing to do with that. The protocol refers to trade rules between the EU single market and Britain, so it's got nothing to do with...
Well, yeah, but it does have something to do with it, doesn't it? Because the reason that they're not meeting is because of the protocol, and then they, if they were to meet, then they could have their windfall tax money.
Well, no, what's going to happen if Stormont doesn't meet, and I think it won't for the time being...
Well, it's been recalled, actually.
I know, they're trying to cobble something together.
On Monday, Northern Ireland Protocol Stormont is recalled after the Sinn Féin petition passes. Northern Ireland Assembly will meet on Monday after a successful petition to recall members back to Stormont. The Democratic Union Party has blocked the establishment of the Assembly since Sinn Féin emerged. The DUP refused to support the election of a new Speaker. The delegation's leader, Congressman Richard Neal from the US, has been criticised for saying the protocol dispute was manufactured, which the DUP said was one-sided. However, Geoffrey Donaldson, their leader, said the US politicians had shown a greater understanding of unionist concerns in a meeting with him on Thursday. So it seems like the Americans are over here sorting out the British government's inability to get the Stormont Assembly together.
Well, the reason there won't be a Stormont Assembly is because the DUP don't want it to sit until the protocol, as they see it, is removed. But it's not going to be removed. So unless the British government decides to go down the road of doing that, and of course there are voices saying exactly that, the Americans aren't happy, and obviously the rest of the EU aren't happy with that. But that means that Stormont will not sit. And that means that the British government direct rule from Westminster will continue in Northern Ireland, which means, of course, that they will get whatever handouts everybody else is going to get, and there just won't be any local input into what goes on.
So although they're meeting on Monday, they can't actually do anything.
Well, they could if the DUP were prepared to join the government.
Will the DUP even turn up?
I think they'll turn up to block it. Like, if they don't turn up, then they need to turn up in order to block it.
Amazing. Okay, so that's the Americans. I don't know. What do you think? It's useful having the Americans intervening, because they tend to be generally pro-nationalist, don't they?
Well, that's because you've got a massive Irish diaspora in the United States. Joe Biden being one of them.
Lobby.
And they fled over there at the end of the famine, and therefore that's their orientation.
Another group that fled over there were the Levellers. Well, they weren't actually the Levellers.
No, the Levellers didn't flee. Colonel Rainsborough. Went to the United States.
That's right. There are quite a lot of people.
It wasn't the United States.
It was a British colony, wasn't it? Yeah. But after the English Civil War, there were quite a lot of people that did go over. They were rather disillusioned with, particularly with the way the Church of England had behaved and the Puritans. So they wanted to have their own religious freedom over in the United States. Of course, that whole situation had to a certain extent been manipulated. They were driven over there, just as the Irish were by the Victorians. Anyway, so Levellers Day now, and I thought we'd start with what I thought was a kind of the key to the day, really, which was Professor Mark Chapman. He's ordained minister, I was told. Well, he might even say that himself here. And he gave the address, really, which was, this is about 7 minutes long, but it gives you a real flavour of what the whole day is about, because he takes you back to May 1649. After the execution of King Charles I, there was a whole turmoil. Well, the country was in turmoil. They weren't necessarily expecting Charles to be executed, because it was Cromwell's son-in-law, Colonel Thomas Pride, that went into Parliament before the vote as to whether to try the king, to arrest all of the MPs that wanted to negotiate with the king. So, of course, when the Parliament voted on it, they weren't there to vote. So this is a great way to fix Parliament. It's just go in and arrest the MPs that are going to vote against you. And after that, there was a lot of change on the side of the pro-parliamentarians, who started, the penny started to drop, or they started to think, well, maybe Cromwell is every bit as bad as the king had been, who we were fighting against. So let's go back to May 1649, on Saturday in Burford in Oxfordshire, and here it's Professor Mark Chapman taking us through the events of the day, dressed in his 17th century ecclesiastical outfit.
Very good to be back here in person this year. Last year there was just a small group of us, but we did gather and we did remember the Levellers, just a few of us. We weren't able to march through the town, so today we can rouse the town as well. But we're remembering the witness of those revolutionaries who died here in this churchyard for their refusal to obey orders. They were the people who stood against unbridled authority and the use of executive power, which wouldn't be constrained by the will of the people. The world of King Charles was a world where sovereignty and authority resided in the centre and were exercised by a monarch and just a few gentry, and they refused to listen to the will of the people. The people were there just to obey their rulers. And that led to radical movements like the Levellers. They were really the revolutionaries of their time. They believed in freedom, in equality, and even the freedom of religion. And that, of course, was novel at the time. All should be free to belong to and to practice whatever faith they wanted. That was really the beginning of human rights. Naturally, at the time, they would all have wanted to belong to Christianity, but the logic is inexorable. Freedom of choice, freedom to believe. So the Levellers were part of the movement that resisted the abuse of power in the name of human rights and in the freedom of conscience. And those are the things we're seeing whittled away today in this country and further afield. The brutal war in Ukraine shows us that peace and security simply can't any longer be guaranteed. They're precarious things. Hungary, Poland and many other places are under threat from populists and nationalists. We can see what unconstrained use of power by the executive can look like. But we can go back to the Levellers to quote one of their early manifestos. Power had to be taken away from all future governments to prevent both kingly or parliamentary tyranny. That message seems as relevant today as it was in 1649. And even in our own continent, we can see a tyrant deceiving the people and engaged in futile war. And here, we can see our own government cynically chiselling away at free speech and the right to demonstrate, destroying our cherished institutions. But the Levellers stood up against tyranny and stood up for liberty and equality. Thomas Rainsborough famously said in the Putney debates, "The poorest he that is in England hath a right to live as the greatest he." The Levellers were the true revolutionaries who stood for a radical reversal of values. Theirs was a vision which led to them to subvert the politics of their world. So we've come today to Burford to remind ourselves again of the importance of that vision of freedom, of equality and justice. And we all have a duty to keep that vision alive. It's a vision in which all can share in the common good, all can share their common humanity, and it's a world in which swords will be turned to ploughshares and war will be no more. And the Levellers died for that vision, and their language was often biblical. Theirs was a vision inspired by the Hebrew prophets and by Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace. They wanted annual parliaments, universal male suffrage, freedom of worship, and rights to land. And for those dreams, those three ordinary soldiers were shot in this place. Of course, that vision seemed quite mad at the time, quite extraordinary, and it threatened the stability of the state. But some of that vision has become a reality. Their deaths weren't in vain, and we're remembering them today to ensure that their martyr's blood remains an inspiration for us in our own struggle for justice and liberty and equality. So today we'll remember them. After I've read through the account of the martyrdom, we'll keep a minute's silence, after which I'll say a short prayer of dedication. The Levellers were inspired by a radical vision of a new world order, and for them it was shaped by Jesus Christ, and it's in their honour that I remember them in prayer. But of course, many of those here don't share that part of the vision. And for those of you who don't believe, or for those who follow other paths, please use this time to rededicate yourselves to their vision, to their dream, to the vision of the kingdom of peace, the freedom of England's green and pleasant land. So here's the account of their execution. Burford, 17th of May, 1649. This day, Cornet Thompson was brought into the churchyard, the place of execution. Death was a great terror to him, as unto most. Some say he had hopes of a pardon, and therefore delivered something reflecting upon the legality of his engagement and the just hand of God upon him. But if he had, they failed him. Corporal Perkins was the next. The place of death and the sight of his executioners was so far from altering his countenance or daunting his spirit that he seemed to smile upon both and account it a great mercy that he was to die for this quarrel. And casting his eyes up to his father and afterwards to his fellow prisoners who stood upon the church leads to see the execution, set his back against the wall and bid the executioners shoot, and so died as gallantly as he had lived religiously. After him, Master John Church was brought to the stake. He was as much supported by God in this great agony as the latter, for after he had pulled off his doublet, he stretched out his arms and bid the soldiers to do their duties, looking them in the face, till they gave fire upon him without the least kind of fear or terror. Thus was death the end of his present joy and the beginning of his future eternal felicity. Let us pray. God of peace and freedom, as we remember the witness of the Leveller soldiers in this churchyard, let us pray that what they stood for will never be forgotten. Let us pray that as your Son Jesus Christ sided with the poor and the outcast, so we will never forget the common humanity of all those who live in this and every land. Let us pray that these revolutionary martyrs whom we remember today might yet play their part in the establishment of your peaceable kingdom here on this earth, where war will be no more, and where all people will live as sisters and brothers, inspired by your vision of justice, of love, and of freedom. This we ask in the name of Jesus Christ, the Son of a Carpenter, and the Prince of Peace. Amen.
So that's Professor Mark Chapman in Burford Churchyard last Saturday.
40,000 names wanted to break those chains of our four friends in the tower. 40,000 names wanted to break those chains when they dragged honest John to the tower. And the streets threw up this bloody cry. We are the Bonnie Besses in the secret dresses, and we spit on your abuse of this power. We say free honest John from the tower. We are the Bonnie Besses in the sea green dresses, and we spit on your abuse of this power. We say free honest John from the tower.
So there was a little group from Oxford singing in the churchyard too. Honest John, John Lilburn. So he was another leveller. He was actually a military commander who was very close to Cromwell, even talking about having slept in the same bed as Oliver Cromwell, which apparently was completely normal in those days. And yet he set himself after the execution of Charles I against Cromwell and as a leveller and a pamphleteer, a very prolific pamphleteer, even writing pamphlets whilst he was in prison in the Tower of London.
Yeah, obviously he's one of the more well-known of the leveller leaders, but of course he wasn't the only one.
So whilst this is also about, obviously it's about 370 years ago, 1649, this all happening, and I find it amazing really that quite a lot of the people at Leveller's Day are still having a go at the king, even though the king had nothing to do with Leveller's Day. He was dead. I mean, he'd been executed in January, February, March, April, May, and this is all 4 months after that, and yet there's a very, very much pro-Republican, pro-Cromwell, well, anti-monarchist faction there. I suppose that's just because the left tends to be much more Republican than monarchist, Martin.
Well, don't forget that these people had just been through one of the most brutal civil wars in our history, fighting against the royalist enemy, and lots of their friends will have been killed.
But they weren't killed by the king, were they? They were killed by Cromwell.
They were killed by Cromwell, but don't forget that these are soldiers who've been fighting in the parliamentary army against the royalists.
This does often happen, doesn't it, in wars, that what you think you've been fighting for one side, it happened in the Spanish Civil War, for example, as well, with a lot of the anarchists, etc. They found that the people they'd been fighting with turned on them as part of the end game of the war.
Well, it's what happens in any revolution. There are more radical factions pushing for things to go faster.
I suppose,
and there are other people saying, hang on a minute, we've gone far enough here.
As the other side gets eliminated, everyone turns on each other.
Anyway, well, it's to do with different interests, isn't
it? Anyway, so down there was the Labour MP, Richard Burgeon, and I had a chat to him about, you know, what is the significance of Leveller's Day today, and also about the cost of living crisis.
My name's Richard Burgeon. I'm the Labour Member of Parliament for Leeds East. And I'm here at the Levellers Festival to commemorate the movement the Levellers were part of that pushed us towards the kind of democracy we've got today, the sacrifices they made, obviously the three Levellers that were executed here in the 1600s, but also to reflect upon the struggles we have today to further improve our democracy and also to defend our democratic freedoms as well. So really for me, this is about history, yes, and reflection on our history, but also reflecting what lessons we can learn from the history in relation to the challenges we face today.
Well, we stood on one of the spots with the first calls for one man, one vote, never mind women, but one man, one vote. Is there a message today that is maybe taking on that message of one man, one vote from 350 years ago?
Yeah, well, Tony Benn, former Labour MP, the legendary Labour MP, who was so much a part of this event since 1975, he famously said that you fight the same battles again and again and again. And he was right when it comes to democracy, because we can't take our democratic rights or our democratic freedoms for granted. And something the government has done which really concerns me and other people across the political spectrum is the introduction of voter ID, where people have to show a passport or driving licence or whatever it may be in order to vote in elections in the future. And we think that will actually suppress the votes. It will discourage people from voting. Electoral fraud, thankfully, hardly ever happens in this country. It's a minuscule problem statistically. And so this, we don't think, is not about having a sledgehammer to crack a nut. It's actually, we think, about the establishment preferring if people don't take part in politics. And we want people to vote, to protest, to strike, to speak their mind, to write, to sing, to do everything which is part of our democracy.
Well, there's three major things as well to do with Priti Patel's various shenanigans at the moment. One is the Julian Assange case she's about to decide on. Secondly, we've also got the traveller protests, and also stopping the traveller criminalisation, and also stopping the right to protest. This is incredible.
Yeah, we've had a real authoritarian drift from this government. And I think the reason for that is very clear. In our society, there are three ways of fighting back against unpopular, unjust policies. Firstly, is through the ballot box. Secondly, is through strike action, through industrial action. And thirdly, is on the peaceful protest. And each of those three rights, this government has got them in the sights. I've mentioned voter ID, which is going to drive down turnout. I've mentioned, or I should mention, the draconian attacks on the right to peaceful protest. Absolutely horrific. And then, of course, we've got the whole series of anti-trade union laws making it harder and harder for workers and their trade unions to take strike action lawfully. And so all these ways we've got fighting back against unpopular government policies are being undermined. It's important that we fight back against that and stand up for our democratic rights.
A lot of journalists are concerned about what's happening to Assange. Basically, he hasn't actually even committed a crime in Britain. How do you think Priti Patel's going to decide? Because there may be legal action after that, but it could be a hammer blow. I think it was Peter Oborn writing in The Guardian yesterday saying this is a green light to war criminals all across the world.
Well, I've put down early day motions in Parliament about Julian Assange. I attempted to visit him in Belmarsh prison, but was denied access. I wrote with other members of Parliament and Lords to protest against this. To no avail. And I've worked alongside the Don't Extradite Assange campaign and, of course, Stella, Julian's wife, on this great injustice. People need to be clear that Julian Assange is not a criminal. Journalism is not a crime. Exposing war crimes is not a crime. And, of course, we have a perverse situation where a political prisoner, Julian Assange, could be extradited to the United States to spend the rest of his life behind bars for revealing to the world, working with The Guardian and other mainstream newspapers, for revealing to the world war crimes done in our name. And that's a fundamentally important part of our democracy, knowing what acts are taken in our name. And people should be clear as well that it's not just the fate of Julian Assange as an individual and his family, as crucially important and heartbreaking as that is. This is about, I think, the United States government, and if the UK government goes along with it and agrees to the extradition, this is about the establishment sending a warning to journalists around the world. If you reveal war crimes, if you whistleblow, if you reveal some of the things that go on in the name of the public, then you too could end up treated like Julian Assange. I think it's meant to be an act of intimidation against other journalists. And for that reason, as many people as possible, whether they're on the left of politics or not on the left of politics, everybody who believes in freedom of speech, in journalism, in accountability, should campaign against the extradition of Julian Assange to the United States.
Finally, the big issue at the moment is a cost of living crisis. Lots of talk about gas, petrol, diesel, but not a lot of talk about rent. We've got rents going up and many tenants being told, well, I'm very sorry, but we've got a queue of people wanting to take your tenancy. You're going to have to pay more or you're out.
Yeah, it's appalling. And we really do need intervention by the government into the private rented market, because more and more people have ended up in overpriced, completely unsuitable and inadequate private rented accommodation. And that's not good. So not only do we need a programme of building council houses, a programme of building 100,000 council houses a year at least, we also need to increase the rights of tenants, including rent caps, including bans on evictions. You know, we need to really bolster the rights of tenants and rebalance things.
OK, Richard, thanks very much for joining
us. My pleasure.
So that's Richard Burgeon there, Martin. Gives a pretty good account of himself, and he's looking at these various attacks. I think he did a very good job there in spelling out the various attacks on different aspects of our democracy, that is, including this very important aspect of voter ID and the idea that we've got to have some sort of special pass in order to vote to stop fraud. The only thing is, there's hardly any fraud anyway.
Well, the Tories have copied that from the Republican strategy in the US, which is that you have to, you know, people have to register to vote, and you make it as difficult as possible for poor people, black people, the people you don't want to vote, to register. That's what the civil rights struggle in the 60s was all about.
Well, this is one of the reasons, apparently, that Biden did so well, is because the Democratic Party spent the Trump years preparing and making sure as many Democratic people, Democrat potential voters in the states, had that ability to vote, because the Republicans had been shutting them out for years.
Yeah, that's what they call voter suppression. And, of course, it was exactly the way that the Unionists used to run Northern Ireland before the the explosion of rage in 1969. It's blatant. They're going to redraw constituency boundaries on the basis of the existing electoral registers, which we know totally, there's loads and loads of people not registered to vote as we speak. Now, it should be quite straightforward for the government to register everybody to vote. It shouldn't be a voluntary thing. You just register everybody to vote. And that's quite simple. But they won't do it because the whole idea of democracy is conditional in the United States and Britain. And don't forget, in Northern Ireland, local elections, you have to be a householder to vote. You're not just being a citizen wasn't enough. And of course, the allocation of council housing to Protestant families or unionist families was a way of giving the head of the household a vote, but the others did not get to vote.
Anyway.
And it's a way of, you know, making sure that it's a property-owning democracy and the people with no property are to be excluded.
Well, he had a lot to say about Julian Assange. The Morning Star's article on the Assange family having renewed hope after a change of government in Australia, as also hovering next to Stella, Julian's wife, is John Rees. He seems to pop up everywhere from the Socialist Workers' Party. And what do you make of this change of government? Because what they're saying, and of course I imagine this includes John Shipton, who we've had on this show several times, saying the newly elected Australian government may pave the way for Julian's release and return to Australia. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, the new Prime Minister, has previously expressed his support for the WikiLeaks founder, who spent the last 3 years in Belmarsh prison and, of course, a decade under house arrest, etc. In February last year, he said that enough is enough, adding he can't see what's served by keeping Julian Assange incarcerated. Mr. Albanese is also a signatory to the Bring Julian Assange Home petition, so there's some hope maybe that the Australians are going to start using a bit of leverage to get Julian released.
I think that his name is Albanese because he's of Italian origin. His family are Italian.
Albanese, okay, yeah. Pronunciation.
Yeah.
Right, fine.
Well, I think it's a good thing. I mean, he's definitely regarded as being somewhat on the left of the Labour Party. You know, he's got a fairly humble background that he came from. And it may, I think the vested interests in Australia, which are against any kind of radical change, you know, the Rupert Murdochs and all the rest of it, and Linton Crosbys are going to try and sabotage anything he might try and do. But I think it's also significant that he is on the record as saying that Assange should be released.
But
why isn't Keir Starmer on the record saying that Assange should be released?
Because Keir Starmer is on the record when he was at the Crown Prosecution Service for persecuting and prosecuting Julian Assange.
Indeed. So, in other words, there's a split opening up between the Australian Labour Party and the British Labour Party.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it, that they can't do anything here. Anyway, also, Labour MP over in Australia, Mark Dreyfus, interesting surname there, with the anti-Semitism scandal over in France at the turn of the 19th century, who is widely expected to be named as Attorney General. He's also spoken of the need to bring the matter to a close. Assange's brother, film producer Gabriel Shipton, said his sibling is being persecuted for publishing the ugly truth about war. Julian is accused of what investigative journalists do all the time, sourcing and publishing materials from a source, Chelsea Manning in this case. Those releases exposed war crimes in Iraq, undocumented civilian deaths in Iraq, government malfeasance, all sorts of things. Now, of course, they're exposing crime, and he has been jailed for exposing crime, Martin.
Well, that's right, and this is a slippery slope. It's quite clear what the deep state wants to happen here, and I think it's quite disgusting that mainstream liberal and Labour opinion in this country hasn't seen fit to stand up to this bullying. But it may be that in Australia, the larrikins are going to turn up and change the game.
Well, I like to look at these things in diplomatic terms. In other words, State Department, Foreign Office deciding these things, because it seems quite clear that this is not an independent judicial decision. It's a political decision. Julian is a political prisoner. He's only in jail because the politicians are corrupt and crooked and have put him in jail, even though he hasn't committed any actual crime here in Britain at all. So it is interesting to see the... we don't normally have lots of Americans being extradited to Britain or the other way around. around. I mean, we've had things in the past. No, certainly not high-profile cases. Both countries seem to, you know, be reluctant to do things like handing over someone like Julian Assange. On the other direction, that is to say, the people in the United States, the British is requesting the extradition of, who committed crimes here, is starting to mount up, Martin, isn't it? So not only have we got the US diplomat's wife, Anne Sekulis, charged just last week over the death of a British teenager. She's caused death by dangerous driving. The wife of a US diplomat has been charged with causing the death of British teenager Harry Dunn by dangerous driving, involved in a car crash outside an Air Force base in Northamptonshire, RAF or USAF Croughton, in August, which Harry Dunn was killed, 19 years old. She was driving on the wrong side of the road, allegedly. After the crash, Sekulis left the UK against the wishes of the British Foreign Office. She claimed diplomatic immunity, which she didn't actually have. So they are now saying they want her back, they want her extradited. So there's one that may be heading the other way. But this week we heard of another one, quite important, high-profile case. Kevin Spacey, who's the former director of the Old Vic in London, has been charged with 4 sexual assaults in Britain. Hollywood star Kevin Spacey is charged with sexually assaulting 3 men in the UK. Crown Prosecution Service this week said the Oscar-winning actor will face 5 charges, 4 of sexual assault and 1 for another serious sexual offence. The incidents are alleged to have taken place in London between March 2005 and August 2008 and in Gloucestershire in April 2013. The Metropolitan Police says the alleged victims are mostly in their 30s and 40s. CPS has authorised charges and they has not been formally charged yet because he's not in Britain. They want him extradited, Martin, to come and answer for these crimes over here. So it's almost like a sort of little bit of a diplomatic battle building up between the US and Britain here, with Julian on one side of the Atlantic and Kevin Spacey and Anne Sekulis on the other.
Well, I mean, in theory, the judiciary in both countries is supposedly independent.
Don't make me laugh.
Well, there you go. I think the Assange case in particular demonstrates the busted flush that is the British legal
special
system.
Relationship between the United States.
As I said last week, there is no case to be made in English common law against Julian Assange, and the fact that the state is determined to extradite him, he's not even a British citizen, an Australian citizen, to a foreign country for doing something which isn't a crime in English law, is. That's the sort of thing that the Magna Carta signed in 1215 was supposed to put an end to.
Well, look,
and here we are just doing it.
1215, we're talking about now.
Well, indeed, that's how old the principle is.
The real issue here is whether the British establishment is now looking at the whole situation with Julian in Australia, thinking, actually, this could be an absolute disaster if Julian goes back, you know, with a very important relationship we've got with the Aussies.
Well, the thing is that at the end of the day, both the Australians and the British are basically the lapdogs of the US. I mean, that's why the Australians have bought the supposed British nuclear submarines so that they can go to war with China, all of which is absolutely bonkers. I mean, Australia is in Southeast Asia. Their nearest neighbour is Indonesia, which is actually, you know, on the fence between China and the West, and they need to have good relations with them. Nevertheless, the mentality in Australia is like a great big home counties in the sky, you know. They see themselves as more pro-American than anything else, or certainly Murdoch and people of his ilk. But, of course, in the past, Australian Labour governments have been much more independent. Gough Whitlam's government was. But then they were overthrown by an internal coup.
So do you think this change of government in Australia could be a bit of a game changer here?
Well, it could be, because don't forget you've got the same sort of thing happened in Australia, in New Zealand, with the Labour government, Labour Green coalition there. And, of course, Albanese won't be able to form a government just from the Labour Party. He'll have to bring some other people in. And of course, you've got compulsory voting in Australia and proportional representation. So it's quite possible that you're going to get an Australasian model of how you could, perhaps for a Labour government here. And of course, you know, that, I mean, in the past, that's been the case, that Australasia Labour governments have actually been a model for doing things back home, I mean, here in the home
it
country.
It strikes me that the British royal family is in a bit of a state, in a bit of a crisis in this Jubilee year. The last thing in the world they need is to have the Australasians all saying, we've got no confidence in the United Kingdom anymore.
Well, I mean, let's face it, they're on the other side of the world, and it's not a question. The question is, I mean,
well, hang on, they're on the other side of the world, but it's a very tiny world in the 24-hour rolling news world.
I think
everybody in New Zealand and Australia has heard about what's going on to Assange. Everyone is watching it.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, this, as you say, the world is a very small place these days. I think in Australia, you've got more of a push for a republic. And left-wing Australians are quite keen on having a republic, less the case in New Zealand. But, I mean, ultimately, even if you're going to keep the monarchy, you've got to have a proper democracy, which doesn't mean putting people like Assange in solitary confinement in the United States.
In a minute, part two, where we look at Kevin Cahill, extended interview with Kevin about this year's rich list and this Labour Party lifetime gifts tax. Also, the fake Bill Cooper by the name of Alex Jones and the fake Ivan Fraser by the name of David Icke.
the turkeys in the oven, and the Christmas presents are bought, and Santa's in his module, he's an American astronaut. Do you spare one thought for Jesus, who had nothing but his thoughts, who got busted just for talking and befriending the wrong sorts? When winter
From 1972, The King Will Come, from their wonderful little Argus album. I remember being completely bemused, as I suppose I would have been about 17 or something, hearing that for the first time. And before that, Lindisfarne, Winter Song from 1970. So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show, for those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So let's start, Martin, I think, with the rich list this week. Good old Kevin. It's always good to have him, I think, because he's someone that worked in the Fleet Street when it actually was, well, just after, I suppose, it was Fleet Street, and working for people like Andrew Neil at the Sunday Times in an era where, as we're about to hear, there was a bit of a contest going on behind the scenes as to who was going to be in the rich list and who wasn't. You know, some people were so wealthy and powerful, they wanted to, you know, leverage their power to keep their names out of the rich list.
Well, as you can imagine, some people are very, very wealthy. Semyon Mogilevich, for example, springs to mind, the chief capo of the Russian mafia, and he doesn't necessarily want to be on that list, does he?
No, he certainly doesn't. This did come up at Prime Minister's Question, so before we hear from Kevin, let's have a little listen to that. And it's nice to see that some MPs are watching, noticing that the actual cost of living crisis is really just a massive gulf of wealth divide opening up between the powerful wealthy and the non-powerful poor, who don't seem to be being very well represented by the Labour Party these days. So back to Prime Minister's Questions.
Andy MacDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Under the cover of the pandemic, we've seen a massive shift in wealth from the poorest to the richest. A partying PM and a law-breaking rich list Chancellor have lined the pockets of their wealthy pals, whilst upwards of 175,000 of our fellow citizens have died from COVID. And they're now sitting on their hands and laughing in our faces as the cost of living crisis and fuel poverty could well leave thousands more to die of cold in their own homes. So, Mr. Speaker, when we saw pictures of the PM partying in the middle of the pandemic, was he toasting his assault on the working class? And I ask him, how on earth does he sleep at night with so much blood on his filthy, privileged hands?
Mr. Speaker, from furlough onwards, everything we have done since the pandemic began has been to get money into the pockets of the working people of this country. And those are the people time and again that we have prioritised. And I do not for a moment doubt, Mr. Speaker, that things are tough. I do not doubt it for a moment. But it is our intention to get this country through it, and we will get through it very well by putting our arms around people as we can and as we will because of the fiscal firepower that we have, Mr. Speaker, but also by making sure that we continue with the high wage, high skill, high employment economy that we have. And the best thing to get money to people's pockets, Mr. Speaker, is to have a job.
Well, it's the same old, isn't it?
But the trouble is, of course, a job is no longer a route out of poverty.
No, it's not. And in any case, the idea that we've got this super-duper economy is absurd. I mean, we've got a very, very lopsided economy,
it's an economy
which is not just unjust, because of the maldistribution of wealth, it's grotesquely inefficient for the reasons that Michael Hudson was explaining earlier.
It's sort of a predatory economy, really, isn't it? That tries to force people into a kind of economic cage where they've got no freedom whatsoever. They just have to work all hours God sends and then cross their fingers and hope they can afford to pay the bills.
Yes, and of course this is the net result of decades of neoliberal austerity, Thatcherism, whatever you want to call it. We've run ourselves into the ground, and it's going to take an awful lot to turn that round.
Well, it's amazing because some MPs are saying that, oh, well, actually what's happening this week, particularly with Rishi Sunak's announcement over the extra payments to people on various benefits and pensioners, is that the government shouldn't be doing this because it's spending too much.
Stevenson. Labour and socialism has failed this country because they've followed policies which interfere too much in people's lives, over-regulate, spend too much taxpayers' money, borrow too much, and raise taxes. Could the Prime Minister tell the House what policies his government are going to follow to ensure we don't have a similar fate?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I can. And I'm grateful to my honourable friend, and he's absolutely right. That Labour's instinct everywhere and always is to put up tax with all its that's what they well, they're bragging about it today, Mr. Speaker. It's ludicrous. What we are doing is not only cutting people's contributions under national insurance, but also helping businesses to invest with the 130% super deduction that my honourable friend put in. And what that is doing is helping us to have a high-wage, high-skill economy with unemployment. And that's why I said this before, Mr. Speaker, at the lowest since 1974.
Well, he said there that they're cutting national insurance, but they're not. They've increased it. And, of course, what they're doing is they're shifting taxation from the wealthy to the poor. So things like national insurance are much less progressive than income tax.
And what about these things like these congestion charges and the so-called clean air charges when we've got air quality improving in Bristol and London, yet the government is slowly but surely adding these extra costs to poorer people. And if you're wealthy enough to afford a brand new Range Rover or BMW Chelsea tractor, you don't pay a penny.
Well, I mean, the overall burden of tax has shifted dramatically in my lifetime, and of course the actual level of tax hasn't changed that much. It's just shifted from wealthy people to poor people, and of course that's ultimately self-defeating because there are more poor people than wealthy people, and they ultimately their consumer spending is what ought to be driving the economy. But of course they're going to saw off the branch they're sitting on. They'll probably be forced to carry on spending and printing money because they haven't really got any other options, because they're not going to raise taxes on their own. That's definitely not going to happen. So we're careering into an inflation crisis, which is actually a deflation crisis because wages are falling. And then there will be a property market collapse. And then, of course, relatively comfortable people will wake up to the mess that this Conservative government has created.
OK, so well, let's go to have a listen to Kevin Carhill now, former Sunday Times Rich List journalist. Actually, let's let him introduce himself to give us his take on this year's Sunday Times Rich List.
My name is Kevin Carhill, and I'm a journalist. And a long time ago, I worked at the Sunday Times on the Rich List. I was eventually the deputy editor.
Can you give us an idea of what the task was like in uncovering people's hidden wealth when you were at the Sunday Times?
Well, start with the Queen, who was very difficult. For the first 5 or 6 years, the Queen topped the list. And she topped the list because we said, probably me in particular, that she owned the Crown estate. Well, the first thing the coalition government did in 2010 was grant her the ownership of the Crown estate. But the palace phoned Murdoch and told him that having the Queen at the top of the list was discrediting the list, that we were mixing up her state asset, her non-personal assets with her personal assets. And then the Tory Lib Dem coalition government fixed that. She became the legal owner of the Crown Estate. So that was the first one we had a problem with. Murdoch intervened and persuaded the editor that it would be better to reduce the Queen's holdings to a nominal. They're about 290 million, but that's a fraction of, if the Crown Estate is worth 10 billion, she would still be up in the top 10.
So what is a non-personal asset? Surely it's an asset which the Queen, even whether or not she actually owns it in a personal capacity, she still controls it.
Well, that applies to the palaces and everything. But we would have always accepted that there are things like Buckingham Palace that are in theory, at any rate, it's never clear. There's nothing in writing. But that they really belong to the state and the people. Although you wouldn't believe that if you tried to get into Buckingham Palace.
That's because the state pays for its upkeep, and large amounts of money going to pay for its upkeep, even though it's her house.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, she's the head of state, and the head of state typically has a decent pad. And we would not, but the Crown Estate was different. I always felt, and I read all the documents and the history, I always felt that was hers, and then the government made it hers, so that solved the problem. Except she never went back to her proper position in the Sunday Times Rich
List. So you think she should be number one still?
No, she wouldn't make number one. She'd be around about 10. Yeah, she'd be nine or... Yeah, she'd be about number 10 or 11.
So is there any distinguishing between her and, say, Prince Charles? He's also very personally wealthy with the Duchy of Cornwall.
He's the personal owner of the Duchy of Cornwall, which has property all over the place. And he would be a billionaire. He'd be worth about a billion based on the assets in the duchy. And they talk about him being the trustee. But if you're a permanent trustee, i.e., you know, if it passes from you to your son and so on and so on, you own it. And he has the he can't dispose of the duchy as such. There is a restraint in the Duchy of Cornwall Act. But there's nothing after that, he runs it. His council and his advisors.
What about the latest Rich List? How accurate do you think that is in describing the actual wealth, including the hidden wealth?
Take one example, the Duke of Westminster, the seventh Duke, the current one, Grosvenor. As long ago as 30 years ago, Richard Norton Taylor at The Guardian established that all the Westminster assets are held in offshore trusts. What Richard wasn't able to find was where they were. I think they're in Canada, but they could be anywhere. But he's in at about 11 billion, and double that. So there's never been a denial that the assets are held in trusts. Where the trusts are has never been revealed.
The Duke of Westminster is not only a large landowner of country land, you know, woodland, farmland, that sort of thing, but he's also a massive owner, isn't he, in the posh parts of London, like Mayfair.
300 acres, the freeholds of, mostly. I mean, that, nowadays, well, that would give him a value of 5 billion. Perhaps 10. Hard to pin it down because the freeholds are quite widely. I did some work on trying to establish which of the freeholds were the Grosvenor estate, but I had the same problem Richard Norton Taylor had. I couldn't establish where the trusts were. Now, for tax purposes, not the present Duke, but the last one, did say he was the beneficiary. He actually made a declaration that he was the beneficiary of the trusts, but he didn't say where the trusts were.
Okay, do you want to just take a look at this weekend's Rich List then, and pick out some names from there?
Well, what I'd want to pick up is there are several people on the Rich List who are sanctioned because of their contacts with Putin. First of all, I personally wouldn't object in any, you know, to people who want to live in Britain, so long as they pay their taxes. That should be the thing. But here, you can have a, you know, £300 million pad in Bishop's Avenue in London, and you pay 30 grand and you don't pay any taxes on your other assets. And in some cases, there are people with, where's this list gone? Extremely significant assets. Alisher Usmanov, some of them have assets that are connected, according to the government, to Putin. So they're living, one of them, I can't remember which it was, tried to pay his dentist and found his credit card was stopped, and he's in the rich list at 10 billion. So there are people on the rich list who are sanctioned by the British government now. Mikhail Friedman, Moshe Kantor, and others. Most of whom acquired, but there's something very important, and I hadn't seen the book. I don't know how I missed it. There's a book called Kleptopia by Tom Burgess, a Financial Times writer. And if you want to know the true extent of corruption in the higher levels of society, especially the wealthy, that I'm surprised Tom Burgess is still alive. He named the names. He named the guilty. And he connected them to the wealth. Of course, you probably know that some London law company tried one of these slap cases against Tom. One of the crooks put in a truthful statement that he thought Tom had got privileged information about a company he used to own. Well, Tom did. And what the privileged information showed was that Putin and his people owned one third of all the assets behind the scenes. That these wealthy, these Russian billionaires were actually front men for the Putin crowd.
Well, yeah, but they might well argue, Kevin, that they are trying to sort of keep one foot on both sides of the fences in the dispute between East and West over the last few decades, in that they want to have assets in London as well as in Russia. They're not necessarily loyalists one way or the other. They're surely waiting to see the way things develop as to which way to jump.
One or two of them have actually criticized the war, but that, I don't think that's the... I think the real issue, and it's in Burgess's book, and it's really spelt out in a way I had never seen it before. He picks the crooks who stole the assets, but who were especially the ones who were close to Putin, and most of them got the assets by effectively it was theft. You know, state assets came on the market and it was rigged, and certain people got the bulk of the
we're
assets.
We're talking here about the oligarchs in the 1990s, yeah?
Well, there's the problem with the oligarchs is everybody in the UK, and I would include Tom in this, is ferocious and amazing. There's no... Tom's book is... I've never seen a book like it. But they've forgotten the other oligarchs, including Rupert Murdoch. There's two sets of oligarchs, and you know what? Well, who was it? Said it. Oh, behind every great fortune lies a great crime. Yeah. And the focus right now is, of course, on the Russian oligarchs, as nasty a bunch as you would ever hope to meet in a day's walk. But on the other side are the oligarchs, if you like, that in my old stories, the ones who are currently imposing criminal and unlawful mass surveillance in the United Kingdom and getting away with it.
Well, this is what bothers me, is if you're a multi-billionaire and you have your assets squirreled away in the Cayman Islands or somewhere, you effectively can, you could be one of the wealthiest people in the country and be paying less tax than somebody that's on medium sort of low wages.
Yep, a doctor perhaps, would pay more tax than a great number of the people on the rich list who have houses here and small palaces and what have you. They pay 30 grand and that's it. And their assets, this is the other part of the scandal. Back in the 1930s or even earlier after World War One, the very rich and the aristocratic in the United Kingdom and the palace set, and it's important to say that, developed this concept of offshore ownership. It started with Canada, but then suddenly they discovered all these little islands, Jersey, Isle of Man, Guernsey, and so on. And the palace crowd, especially the aristocrats with assets, put the ownership of the assets, you know, in Bermuda, the Virgin Islands, Grand Cayman, whatever you have. And none of those, and they all belong in it, you know, they're all governed by Britain, or ruled by Britain. They're British colonies. And anybody with money can hide anything they like in the British offshore islands. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace because a lot of them are, some people make money reasonably, but an enormous amount of the money in the British offshore islands was stolen, especially in Africa and then Russia.
We had a clip from an interview Ben Norton has done from his Multipolar World podcast with an economist called Michael Hudson last week, and he's talking about this whole idea of the financialization of the economy, which means everything being turned into financial assets and basically untaxed, so that those savings that people are getting, hoarding basically, provides them with a very good income. But they're not actually producing anything from it. It's just the financial services industry slowly but surely swallowing up the rest of the economy, and of course making it impossible for industry to thrive, because they are charging enormous amounts of money for basic things like housing, water, most importantly recently we've seen energy, gas, petrol, diesel, and that these sorts of economies, Michael Hudson argues, Kevin, are basically down a cul-de-sac. They're going to hit a brick wall very soon because they can't compete internationally.
I'm dead on. I think he's got his finger there. And again, that's what the Tom Burgess's book shows, that places like the Congo and places like Zimbabwe had all their assets financialized and moved out of the country. So no benefits go to, you know, the ordinary person in the Congo. They all go to the people who own the assets in places like Bermuda, the Bahamas, Cayman Islands, and so on. The benefit of the ownership goes to these crooks. A lot of them are out.
A rentier economy, this is the French word, because you're basically just playing golf whilst your rent income from your property or from your assets provides you with an income, and everyone else is struggling to work for you. But I did an article recently for Levellers Day, actually, looking at the Labour Party's campaigns around the 2019 election. And there were press reports saying that the what they call lifetime gifts tax, that they were, it was in a George Monbiot report, which the Labour Party took up, called Land for the Many, that there could be 10 million people brought into, somewhere between 5 and 10 million, brought into having to pay some kind of inheritance tax on their home. That is to say, if the children didn't have assets or cash of around something like £10,000, £20,000, £30,000 to pay, they would have to sell the house. So the house would not be passed on. It would go out onto the open market, maybe be snapped up by a bank or whatever. Now, in the modern world, surely we've done quite a good job, haven't we, Kevin, in buying since the Second World War houses. It seems that the Labour Party is keen on the idea that inheritance tax shouldn't apply to just to massive estates, like, you know, the old feudal estates, that it should be ordinary people, anyone with a home over about £300,000, which I'm afraid is lots and lots of places nowadays, particularly in London. And even if you look at London, this is social cleansing. So if you've got a house which has gone up in value because of the housing bubble to astronomical amounts, as many in London have, you won't be able to pass it on to your children, and you'll have to the kids will have to move out of London. So I just wonder what you make of this Labour policy, if you've come across this before or back in 2015.
We've come across it twice. The Tories promised to deal with it by raising the level to £1 million. This was supposed to reflect the change in the value of houses and to more easily reflect the value of ordinary homes, yeah? And they never did it. It's still likely to have exactly the effect you've just described. Ordinary people, with it, especially in London, with it... terraced house will find themselves, the children will have to sell the house to pay the tax.
What are they doing there structurally? Because this is quite important. You know, if we're working our lives for a house, then we can't pass it on to our kids.
I don't think either parties have grasped it. What's lacking in both of them is our numbers to work out what to do and where to set the level so that most people don't pay tax and can pass their houses on. You need proper figures, and those are missing. This, do you remember way, way back, I used to count the number of houses and how many, you know, people had and how where they were and all this sort of thing. Neither party have done this, and they've got to go back and get figures and say, no, the majority of people now own houses that are homes that are worth 1.2 billion or some 1.2 million. And you must shift the level up to 1.5 million before the heirs pay tax.
I mean, it seems that both parties quite like the idea that people won't own their own homes, but will be in the future
renting. No, yeah, they will be the whole.
And this also goes along, doesn't it, with Klaus Schwab, Prince Charles, and their World Economic Forum idea of you will own nothing but be happy.
Something like that. Well, do you remember? I could see it at the time, and not many people seemed able to see it. I think you did. Maggie Thatcher was trying to drive everybody into renting. Her real idea was to convert the whole economy into a rentier economy. And she did it in one sense. Everybody jumped up and down when she sold council houses, but she didn't allow the councils to replace the council houses, meaning she was driving people into either very expensive mortgages, which people overlooked, or into renting. And the number of people renting now in the United Kingdom is very high compared with what it was 40 years ago. It's a rentier. You put your finger right on it. It's a rentier economy. And the people benefiting from the rentier economy are mostly the people in the rich list who have got their assets in the Bahamas, Cayman Islands, whatever.
Okay, back to the rich list again, Kevin. Do you think that there are any indications as to who is now at the top of those lists? So, you know, maybe they're oligarchs. Do you think there may be, you know, or who is it that's owning most of the wealth now? Because we do seem to have a system which is set up to funnel wealth from the poorer to the richer. It's actually controlled and owned, it seems, by the super rich to make sure that what they do is just acquire more and more wealth.
And the person who defined what this was all about was George Soros. Do you remember George Soros? The guy who bankrupted Britain during the John Major's government. George is one of the great, I don't know what you call him, but Soros is a billionaire many times over, and he did it by currency gambling, especially against the pound. But Soros, he described this form of capitalism as bandit capitalism. That's what he called it. And he said, so long as you make it legal for me to play the game, I will. That was why he told the UK not to leave to join the euro. He said, so long as you're a small offshore currency, I'll continue to speculate against you and I'll make money. Soros was brutal in his honesty about what was going on, but he said, so long as it's legal, I'll do it. And that's one of the problems, is the present Tory government have made it incredibly easy for this to happen. You know, for the wealth to go up to those with their assets offshore and all the rest of it, and still live here and have a very comfortable British life and spend their money here, which is excellent. But the balance is all wrong. And the drive in the Tory-driven economy is towards making people rent, because that's where these people, the people on the rich list, get all their money.
Yeah, it's almost like a kind of feudal society that they seem to be. Can you just tell us what you think about the cost of living crisis, how that's impacting? I mean, this is not only rent, we've got mortgages going up too now, and also, of course, astronomical profits from the oil and gas industry.
Well, again, there's nothing, conventionally, they have made excess and unfair profits. And, of course, an enormous number of people, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, are now going to food banks and haven't got the money to pay for heating and food and so on. And one of the major beneficiaries are the oil, gas, and the oil giants, and they are ripe for having the excess profit. During the war, we did the same. The level of profit you could make was limited. And after that, the government took the lot. In this case, you know, a tax on the excess profit is more than reasonable.
Well, what about public ownership, have some of saying?
Again, you wind up, as you would know more than most, you wind up with a bureaucracy. And if you're not prepared to address the issue of bureaucracy, you know, public ownership is a nonsense. One of the things these people do, the people with all this immense wealth, is they take advantage of bureaucracy. The government fiddles a little clause at the back of a bill, which changes everything, and nobody notices it. And the media in particular are absolutely diabolical at watching the small shifts that have big effects, that aid the bureaucracy and then, in the end, aid these people to have bandit capitalism operating.
Is there any way, simple way, to fix this massive funneling of wealth from the middle classes and the poor to the rich, Kevin?
There is. You end all offshore tax concessions. You say, you live in Jersey or you have your assets in Jersey, fine. They'll be treated as if they're here in the UK. But most certainly the current government, if you read Tom Burgess's book, is absolutely saturated with money from those classed as real criminals. Let's say there's a middle ground of people who may have made money because they were clever entrepreneurs, Russians. But there was a kleptocracy operating in Russia when the Soviet Union collapsed, and they are the current oligarchs. And the way to stop all this is to make the offshore islands, any offshore islands, domestic jurisdictions of the United Kingdom, then you can reverse it.
I mean, I may be wrong, but it sounds to me as if the major problem that's caused all this is Margaret Thatcher's scrapping exchange controls. The idea that you can move money around the world really only started in, put it wherever you want, in 1980 when Thatcher took power.
Yep. Now, she knew what she was doing. And there has been no effective change at all in the offshore fiddle. The offshore islands are exactly now as effectively, let's go be right about the words, Guernsey, Jersey, the Isle of Man, the Caymans and everywhere else are where the bandits hide their money. And we let them, and we make it legal to do it. And we have more, the United Kingdom is in a much better position to crunch on these people than anyone else.
Okay, Kevin Carhill, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, Tony, bye.
I thought a terrific insight from Kevin there into this whole sort of wealth divide, which isn't really well analysed at all by the mainstream press, Martin, for obvious reasons, is that they control the press.
Indeed.
Own it.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, all these major press institutions have got their money offshore too.
That's right. And of course, if everybody's doing it, everybody feels that they're entitled to do it. And it becomes, well, we can't do anything about it because, you know, I've seen Andrew Neil saying, you know, we can't raise tax on the wealthy because they'll just run away with the money.
Well, I mean, I think it'd be fair. He is a journalist and he'd be putting that argument, you know.
Yes, I know. But I mean,
not necessarily but something he agrees
then,
with.
It then leads to a council of, oh, there's nothing we can do about it, which simply isn't the case.
I would
argue that if you are a British citizen, it doesn't matter where you live. You can live anywhere. But your assets should all be taxed as a British citizen. And that, and if you don't want that and you want to leave the country, then you go, but you lose your citizenship.
Well, I find so
and your children lose their citizenship.
Fascinating about this is that it's almost similar to what Anne Applebaum was saying earlier on, that a lot of the problem is this massive movement of financial assets around the world, that people are using it strategically and politically.
Yes, I mean, of course, what's actually happened, as I said earlier when we were commenting on what she'd said, is this attack on money laundering and you know, tax evasion in different jurisdictions. There's also an element of make-believe and smoke and mirrors, because by attacking, for example, British tax evasion in the Cayman Islands and the Virgin Islands, what's actually going on behind the scenes is people like Biden, who's based in Delaware, that has become a very good place to hide money. And so, therefore, there's actually a politics of attacking tax havens, where some tax havens get attacked, so that actually makes other tax havens more.
Money just shifts about, doesn't
That's
it?
Right,
it's whack-a-mole, basically. What about what Kevin's saying there, and what I was saying about the idea of trying to tax people when the parents die or when they die, so they can't hand on their homes? I mean, this adversely affects. I mean, they're saying, even the Conservatives are saying, you know, oh well, we're going to make it so that only estates over $1 million are taxed. But actually, there's loads of terraced houses in London over $1 million. And this is a form of social cleansing. The idea is that if you're living in London, then you better move out, otherwise you're going to lose your home when you die.
Well, I mean, if you're not going to get the tax off the super wealthy, then you've got to get it from somebody else.
Well, get it off the super wealthy. Why get it off the middle classes?
Well, because the middle...
Or the poor. You know,
because the super wealthy...
So you'd rather tax the middle classes than the super wealthy?
No.
And you think that's okay?
I didn't say that. I just said exactly the opposite, Tony. If you don't tax the super wealthy, then you've got to find the money from somewhere else. And that means the other poor schmucks have to pay it. Because ultimately, if you're going to go to war in the Ukraine and solve climate change and rebuild the infrastructure, it's got to be paid for somehow. You can either print the money or you've got to pay get it through taxes. And if you're not going to tax the wealthy, it means the ordinary punters have to come up with the money, doesn't it?
Well, print the money sounds a better idea. Anyway.
Well, yes, because what you can do with printing the money, and that's what used to happen in the 60s and 70s, is you get a moderate level of inflation going, and that the asset owners are constantly losing value. And that's one of the reasons why the Thatcher and Reagan revolution took place. Because they've made their little nest eggs inviolable.
Well, the opposite's happened now, is everyone's putting their money into housing. And as we were saying earlier, shops and things like that, property, and then just boarding it up because it's like money in the bank.
Well, that's right. It's a misallocation of resources, which is not efficient.
Anyway, our penultimate item this week, we'll leave that and a bit more about all that stuff next week. Looking at this horrific shooting in Texas this week, here's US President Joe Biden reacting to it.
I had hoped when I became president I would not have to do this again. Another massacre. Uvalde, Texas. An elementary school, beautiful, innocent, second, third, fourth graders. And how many scores of little children who witnessed what happened see their friends die as if they're on a battlefield, for God's sake. They'll live with it the rest of their lives. There's a lot we don't know yet. There's a lot we do know. The parents who will never see their child again.
Anyway, so that's, well, I mean, it almost sounds like he's trying to be a very emotional reporter reporting on it. I mean, this is what presidents are supposed to do, Martin, but the whole thing is very, very much emotionally loaded without very much analysis of what actually caused the problem. We heard just today, that the Texas police admitted that they'd lied when they said that they did try to do something about this. Apparently, this guy was shooting and the police didn't intervene at all, even though they had some armed police, very early on in the shooting on the campus of this school. They just basically didn't intervene. They let the guy carry on killing.
Well, I don't know the detail exactly of what happened. What struck me about Biden there was how spaced out he sounded. You know, it's like he can barely string a sentence together, can he? No.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to Paul Craig Roberts giving his on the Richie Allen show, I think was Wednesday evening, talking to on the Richie Allen show. This is Paul Craig Roberts talking about the shooting.
I grew up, everyone had a gun. I think by the time a kid was 10 years old, he had a 410 shotgun and a 22 rifle, and nobody ever shot anybody. Ever. We never shot the cows in the pasture or the mules or ourselves. All of this shooting is a new thing. I forget the first case. The first case was in Texas at a university, and I think it was in the 70s or the 80s. The 70s, I think. And it's a new phenomenon. And so I don't think it has anything to do with guns, because I lived a life with them and so did my friends, and no one ever shot anybody. I think it has to do with what is happening to people. Something is causing people to do things that we would never have thought to do. In fact, it was prohibited by your own internal self-regulation. So something has happened to reduce the quality, the character of people, so that they think they have a right or achieving something by shooting other people that they don't even know, who've done nothing to them. So it seems to me it's a deterioration in the character of the people that produces this. Now, where does it come from? I don't know. I've not studied it. I don't think people do study it. I think instead there's just a sort of a determination to destroy the Second Amendment, because if you can destroy any constitutional amendment, you can destroy all the rest. And they're all under attack. The free speech movement is under attack. The 14th Amendment of equal treatment under the law is under attack. The Second Amendment is always under attack. So I don't think the way you ask the question is even relevant. I know that's the way people think, but it's just not a relevant question. The question is, how come we could grow up in America until, I think it was sometime in the 1970s, before somebody got it in their head, they could go around shooting people.
Yeah. So that's Paul Craig Roberts, former, I think he was in the Treasury, Martin, wasn't he, in the US Cabinet anyway. What he doesn't really say, he goes on actually to talk about Sirhan Sirhan and the murder of Robert Kennedy, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, and the fact that there's all sorts of evidence that he was somehow hypnotized before that, and possibly he didn't actually do the killing, but he was hypnotized to be the patsy. Of course, he's still in jail over in the United States, rotting away. They keep threatening to let him out. But the point here as well with the shooting is the police shoot-to-kill policy. So you can understand that they want to kill the guy, they want to stop him shooting, but they surely, these are marksmen, these are brilliant, you know, snipers basically that the police have got these days. They could disarm him, surely they could shoot his arm, they could, you know, if he's carrying on killing, they could do something, because there'll be no trial here now.
Well, I'm not an expert in these matters, Tony, but I understand that if you are trained as a marks person by the, you know, SWAT teams, by the police or whatever, you obviously have to make, you know, very careful decisions about when you shoot people. But if you shoot people, you shoot to kill. That's standard procedure.
Well, I know that, and I'm saying that it's wrong. What I'm saying is that,
it's not wrong, it obviates, Tony. Maybe the only way to do it.
It may not be. It obviates the need for a trial. And it means that all you're going to get is some kind of, coroner's inquest or whatever they have in the US equivalent. This is a standard procedure now. Just blow the guy's brains out and then he can't shoot anymore. But it's a very, seems to me, lame piece of thinking by the police that you cannot disarm the guy by using a gun. Surely you can. I mean, these are snipers.
Sometimes the police can disarm people. I was on RT some couple of years ago now talking about an incident in Russia. Which is similar to what's happened. It was in the secondary school.
Well, this is the difference, isn't it? There's a difference between the way Russian police operate and the US police.
Well, no,
the British police,
yes,
by the way.
They never shoot to kill policy. But each situation, in any case, is going to be unique in the sense that you don't quite know exactly what you're dealing with in any particular situation. I don't know what's happened in this particular case. No doubt there's going to be an inquiry or a coroner's report or whatever on what's happened here.
What do you think about gun control, then? Do you think this is all about?
Well, I mean, as you know, on the right wing in the US, people talk about these attacks as being a means of gun control. Now, I recognise that in the United States, with so many guns out there, that the idea that you're going to get rid of them all is a non-starter. There's just too many. But I don't see any reason for a country like Britain, where there isn't that many guns, to have the same kind of laws as they do in the United States.
In fact, isn't it part of the reason that the US split off from Britain because of the strict controls over guns that the British had?
Well, no. I think it is. Britain isn't. The United States is.
The right to bear arms.
The United States is unique in allowing, you know, ordinary citizens to have access to quite dangerous weapons.
It's not. It's other countries as well. I'm not sure which.
Well, it's not true.
It's not true in
Russia, for example.
It's not the only country in the world.
Russia, in this particular incident that I was commenting on RT, this boy had bought a repeat action shotgun, which is the kind that was used in what was the name of the place in Devon where the guy used one. I can't remember. But anyway, the point is a pump-action shotgun is an anti-personnel weapon. You don't use it to shoot birds. It's not the sort of thing a farmer would have. And in Russia and in this country before the particular incident I'm talking about, pump-action shotguns were legal to buy. Now, I would argue that a pump-action shotgun is not. It's an anti-personnel weapon used by special forces.
Right, but what about
nobody
this,
should be allowed to buy
what
them.
About this? What about this whole business of the citizenry versus the state? If the state has got the right to bear arms, the citizenry can't rise up against the state.
Well, this is, as you know, this is the gist of the debate in the United States this.
So our final item tonight is the fake Ivan Fraser by the name of David Icke. Let's have a listen to Ivan Fraser now on the John Ronson programme, where he actually calls out Tim Matthews as an agent. He's saying, you're on this programme, you're actually just trying to divert the conversation, which I find fascinating. And I'm putting this on tonight in a way as an appeal. If anybody knows what happened to Ivan Fraser, he just disappeared off the whole face of the earth. In the early 1990s, he called out David Icke as a plagiarist. He was a proofreader for David Icke, and he said that, well, actually, Icke is not writing these books. Someone else is, and Icke is putting his name to them. But anyway, so I think Icke is a kind of a fake version of the real version who used to run the Truth campaign in the early 1990s, Ivan Fraser. So we're going to hear him now, but please do, if you know anything about what happened to Ivan Fraser, I think he was up in Liverpool in the early 90s, and then he sort of seemed to disappear off the face of the earth.
This has been traced back to the Davidic line.
I don't see how you can trace these things back. I mean, it's reductionism. It sounds a bit like a sort of...
It's a whole series of racist type argument.
I mean,
it's a whole series of investigations called history.
If we're talking about remote viewing, surely we're talking about people depending upon your point of view, people are either very important.
You interrupt and break the argument. Every time there's some fundamental information
that's pertaining to this human
well, I'm trying to understand where you're coming from
everything
here
that I feel is so important.
No, because the thing is, you see, I'm trying to understand...
Because I cannot get this information
out. We've got all this stuff about...
Do you think it's been remote viewed?
I honestly think he is a plant to... Whenever anybody comes up with some really serious, important information, he will talk over the top of them. And I picked this up in the green room about him. I am actually quite sensitive and psychic myself, and I can see quite...
I didn't know that.
..a range of energies, and I do believe this is part of his agenda here today.
It must be the implants of my nose. But, I mean, I think the thing is, you see, we've
and
got...
And he's pulled it off to a T today. Every time the important stuff's come up, he's kept the argument on the UFOs, the lesser New World Order... information. There's so much more to the New World Order than just UFOs.
Of course there is, and I agreed with you. We're talking about a wide range of subjects.
We need to explore the other areas of, I feel.
One thing that concerns me about remote viewing is we've heard very sinister...
So there's good old Ivan Fraser there on a John Ronson programme called For the Love of Big Brother back in the late 1990s, or around about 2000, I think it was. Martin, it's interesting what he says there. You don't often see that on a TV programme, do you? Someone's saying, I actually think you're a plant, because every time someone comes out with useful information, you just talk over them and steer the conversation in a different direction.
Well, I'm quite sure that intelligence services have heavily penetrated everything. We know from the Special Demonstration Squad inquiry, which has now been, it's been stopped now, and there won't be any further information for at least a couple of years.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the reasons for that was that the police simply refused to reveal the files.
Well, in other words, if you think that the state has got lots of agents in political organisations in this country and has been trying to steer them in various directions, you are right. That's exactly what's been going on. And I think David Icke is either consciously or unconsciously a plant, because when he talks about 9/11, we then go on to remote viewing, then we go on to the moon being hollow and all the rest
of it. Well, the most importantly, is this whole thing he came out with pretty much straight away when the pandemic started, and that is that COVID-19 doesn't exist.
Yes, in other words, the job of these agents is to just muddy the waters, because with the internet and all the rest of it, there's a lot more information out there, and the way you make sure that you can control that is you make sure there's lots of false information out there, and then you can go on about fake news and all the rest
of it.
And
we'll be doing the fake Bill Cooper by the name of Alex Jones next week, but that was the fake Ivan Fraser. Well, that was the real Ivan Fraser, but the discussion is about the fake Ivan Fraser called David Icke, as he then called Tim Matthews, who's into remote viewing and tried to steer everything to talking about remote viewing and UFOs in that conversation, out as an agent, interrupting, steering the debate on live TV. That was actually 1998, that programme. John Ronson's For the Love of Big Brother. Time to sign off now. Actually, before I say that, anyone had any information about what happened to Ivan Fraser, please do let us know. Contact us one means or another. You can either just comment on the show page or email me or even message, text me, give me a call next week. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Do please send me interviews and story tips via not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. Do please contact us if you have any problems with Radio 4 All, downloading the MP3 files from the server after the show. My paperbacks about the deals between the Allies and the Nazis during the war, the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem, that cost £15. Also my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination called The Siege of Heaven Reader. They're on eBay, and the easiest way to get to all of them and the various versions, including the free ones, is via www.bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, except when we're restreaming the Richie Allen show, and over Sunday lunch at Camberley's RadioQUK.com. Plus, I think he plays it out on Saturdays too. Do please feel free to make live recordings in case we have other problems like we did last week with the Radio 4 All server. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, an art centre on Jamaica Street in Bristol, and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and disinformation is sadly the norm in Britain today, thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream, back to the regular time, mostly at the moment now, it's 5 o'clock, although we might have to switch again to 6 at some point. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. It's going to be a fun.